to be his friend. The new series of Profile on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts next Saturday night at 7.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock and it's Monday, the 26th of August. This is Today with Simon Jack and Lise Doucette.
The headlines this morning. The US says it's working hard to avoid a further escalation in hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon after the biggest clashes in 10 months of cross-border fighting. We'll be live in Beirut just after 7, and at 10 past 8 we're joined by the former head of MI6, Sir John Sawles. The news agency Reuters say a British security adviser working with journalists in eastern Ukraine has been killed in an airstrike on a hotel there. We hear from soldiers in the front line in Kursk, some of whom question why they're there.
This is his latest message. Many of us do not understand the meaning of this operation. It's one thing to fight for Kharkiv or Zaporizhia. It's another matter for the Kursk region, which we don't need.
Also in today's programme, we'll have our final summer book club of the holidays. And
today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do.
I don't believe has the day come. Could an Oasis reunion be on the cards? The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said he's deeply concerned after Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. The US says it's working to avoid a further escalation in hostilities, and Britain has urged all parties in the region to show restraint. Yesterday, Israel struck dozens of sites in southern Lebanon in what it said was a preemptive attack, and Hezbollah launched hundreds of rockets and drones towards northern Israel. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell has sent this report from Jerusalem.
While Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon appear to have paused hostilities, tensions remain dangerously high, triggering international calls for restraint. There are reports of diplomatic efforts through intermediaries to try to contain the situation. In a televised speech, the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah told Lebanon it could take a breath after his group completed its revenge attack for a top commander killed in an Israeli airstrike last month. And US and Israeli officials gave further details of how intelligence had detected signs that Hezbollah was preparing to launch a major missile and drone attack, leading Israeli warplanes to take preemptive action before dawn yesterday. Mediators say that the dramatic attacks have not derailed talks on a Gaza ceasefire, which have been taking place in Cairo, though so far there's been no sign of a breakthrough.
The news agency Reuters has confirmed that a British man working with its team in eastern Ukraine has been killed in a missile strike on a hotel in Kramatorsk. Ryan Evans worked as a safety advisor. The agency said he was one of six employees staying at the Hotel Sapphire. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky condemned the attack.
All day today, debris was being cleared in Kramatorsk after the Russian missile strike. Journalists were among the casualties. A regular city hotel was destroyed by a Russian missile. Absolutely purposefully, in a thought-out way. My condolences to friends and families, and this is everyday terror, which still goes on because Russia has the means to continue.
The messaging app Telegram has condemned the arrest in France of its billionaire founder Pavel Durov. It said it was absurd that its owner, who was born in Russia, was being held responsible for abuses of the platform. The company has been accused of failing to cooperate with investigations into drug trafficking, fraud and child sex abuse images. An amnesty and compensation scheme for people in England and Wales who possess zombie-style knives and machetes starts today, ahead of the weapons being banned next month. New legislation will make it an imprisonable offence to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives favoured by criminal gangs. More details from our home editor, Mark Easton.
zombie knives, Rambo knives, serrated long-bladed machetes, weapons designed to intimidate and terrorise. The government tried a ban in 2016, but a loophole meant some items bypassed the rule. Ahead of the legislation coming into force on the 24th of September, people who currently legally possess such knives can hand them into police stations without fear of prosecution, and in some cases claim compensation. Three zombie-style knives would be worth at least £30 under the scheme.
A 32-year-old woman is in a life-threatening condition in hospital after being stabbed at the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. Two men, aged 24 and 29, were also treated for knife wounds. The main carnival parade takes place later today. Police say a suspected unexploded bomb, which was washed up on a Devon beach yesterday, was swept up back out to sea before it could be properly assessed. It was spotted on the sand in the village of Beer. Jane Prendergast has the details.
The beach at Beer was evacuated after the suspected bomb was seen at around 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. It's believed it was first found by a metal detectorist. The Coast Guard said an explosive ordnance disposal unit came to look at it, but was unable to inspect the shell because of incoming tides. The service said rescue teams would return at low tide to reassess the situation, and in a Facebook post warned people not to touch it if it's discovered back on the shore again.
And there's growing speculation that Noel and Liam Gallagher could end their 15-year feud and stage an Oasis reunion. The Sunday Times reported yesterday that the brothers were set to perform a series of gigs next year. To add to the expectation, Liam Gallagher dedicated the Oasis track Half the World Away to his brother during his set at the Reading Festival last night. And on Instagram, both brothers posted a sign suggesting an announcement could be made tomorrow.
Announcement to wait for. Thank you, Alan Smith. It is now 6 minutes past 6. It's a good time to hear about the weather. Let's hear from Thomas Schaffernacker, who's at our BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning to you, Lise, and good morning to you listening in. We've got a fine day on the way across most of the UK with sunny spells to come and generally dry weather. But for the moment, there's a fair amount of thick cloud shrouding the country, and there are bits and pieces of rain, for example, in Northern Ireland, parts of Scotland, the south of England damp in a few places too. So if you are heading out very early this morning, you may catch a little bit of rain, but it shouldn't be too heavy and it'll be very, very fleeting. And then come the second half of the morning, I think it's brighter skies all round, and then the middle of the afternoon, it's beautiful and pleasant across most of the country. Now, temperatures today, a bit of a range, around 16 degrees across the north of Scotland, 18 in Northern Ireland and around the Lake District, as well as northwestern England, a little bit warmer across East Anglia and the southeast, about 23 degrees. We've got a fine end to the day for most, but then rain is expected to sweep into Northern Ireland and western Scotland by around midnight, or the early hours. And then by tomorrow morning, we're expecting some rain also to nudge into parts of northwestern England, Wales and southwestern England. So that does mean that tomorrow in the west and the north of the UK, we'll have some rain, but some very warm and sunny weather to come tomorrow for East Anglia and the southeast, with temperatures reaching around 25 degrees. And then after that, it's turning pleasant for most of us in the week ahead. Back to you.
Thank you, Thomas. A sunny bank holiday ahead. Good news. Let's have a look at this morning's papers. Several front pages lead on the escalating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. The Financial Times pictures a Hezbollah drone exploding over northern Israel. The Times says the White House has ordered two US aircraft carrier groups to remain in the Middle East to try to prevent the flare-up from escalating into war. The Guardian is reporting that the UK's Attorney General has intervened over the sale of British arms to Israel, arguing that he can't approve a ban without knowing if their use would breach international law.
On the home front, the Daily Telegraph's front page focuses on the letter written by the Conservatives to the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, demanding to know if the Prime Minister or his Chief of Staff Sue Gray signed off on the Downing Street pass for the Labour donor Lord Ali. The paper quotes the letter's author, John Glenn, as saying, "It's time Labour came clean on all the people they've parachuted into the top of the civil service and the donors they've returned favours to." Labour insists the pass was temporary and was given back several weeks ago. The Daily Mail says Lord Ali has paid for thousands of pounds worth of suits and spectacles for the Prime Minister, calling it a passes for glasses sleaze row.
The I says Labour MPs fear of voter backlash over the Chancellor's decision to restrict winter fuel allowance payments. They tell the paper the issue is coming up on the doorstep in emails and letters. One MP is quoted as saying there's a lot of bad feeling about the decision. But the paper says Rachel Reeves has indicated there'll be no U-turn on the policy. The Daily Express says the Shadow Home Secretary James Cleverly has condemned Labour for taking the action without a democratic mandate to do so.
The Guardian predicts that teachers returning to work next month face a post-COVID peak of bad behaviour as children most severely affected by the pandemic reach the teenage years renowned for classroom disruption. The paper says the warning from school leaders in England follows evidence that children of primary school age during the pandemic, when schools were closed to most pupils, have been accruing exclusions and suspensions at a record pace since moving on to secondary school.
The Times says a photograph of Prince Andrew after he gave the Newsnight interview about his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein could go on display in the National Portrait Gallery. The paper says the gallery confirmed the image was being considered after being offered as a gift by the only photographer who was invited to take pictures that day. The Daily Star quotes a royal expert as saying that having the image on display would be a symbol of his disgrace, but the paper notes it could also embarrass the Princess of Wales, who's the gallery's royal patron.
And the Mirror addresses rumours of that Oasis reunion, quoting a source close to the feuding brothers saying, quote, it's happening. The paper claims the frontman Liam Gallagher and his brother Noel are on speaking terms again after their famous fallout 15 years ago. The Sun believes the Gallaghers have decided to launch a £400 million comeback with huge live concerts across the UK next year expected to be confirmed this week. The headline, definitely no maybes.
And we'll get the thoughts of Steve Lamacq and Miranda Sawyer just before the end of the programme on that prospective and possible reunion. It is 11 minutes past six.
Simon, you're really looking forward to that, I can see. To Ukraine now, and six employees working for the Reuters news agency have been killed in a missile strike on a hotel in the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, not far from the front line. They include a British national, Ryan Evans, who was working as a security advisor, Nick Beek. Our Europe correspondent joins us. Nick, what are the details about this attack?
Good morning, Lise. Yes, it was a team of six from the Reuters news agency, and one of the team was killed. He was a 38-year-old man called Ryan Evans, a former British soldier, and Reuters have been paying tribute to him, saying he helped their journalists cover events right around the world, not just here in Ukraine, but in Israel and also recently at the Paris Olympics, and that he would be terribly missed. He'd been with Reuters for the past 2 years, and over the weekend, as I say, he was part of this team of six covering the battle in the east of the country, but there was a direct missile strike on their hotel. Mr. Evans was killed, two other colleagues injured, one of them very seriously. This in the city of Kramatorsk, which is under Ukrainian control, but as you know, Lise, it's only a couple of dozen kilometers away from the front line. President Zelensky has sent his condolences to Mr. Evans's family, and he said that this is the daily Russian terror that continues. Meanwhile, Moscow hasn't said anything about this strike.
Yes, and interesting, it was an attack on Hotel Sapphire. There is a trend, too, where there's been attacks on hotels. But let's ask you, though, but let's move from the east to that surprise incursion into Russia nearly 3 weeks ago. What is the latest from Kursk?
Well, I think the success there, the rapid gains that the Ukrainians made, Lise, certainly shaped and sort of invigorated what were Independence Day celebrations over the weekend. There had been this warning of an increased risk of Russian attacks from the air, from drones, that the Americans, among other people, had been talking about. But that didn't deter many, many Ukrainians coming out to celebrate what's been 33 years of independence. And what's been happening in Russia itself, in the Kursk region, seemed to invigorate people. It's the biggest invasion of Russia since the Second World War. And we know that 3 weeks on, the Ukrainians are still there. Around 10,000 elite troops were sent over the border. But As we've been talking about, it remains a high-risk gamble. And over the last couple of days or so, for this programme, we've been talking to soldiers who've been telling us that the Russian operation is getting stronger there, and also that the Ukrainian operation on the front line of Ukraine itself in the east, that remains difficult, and they hadn't seen this great surge of Russian troops being moved away from the front line.
And we'll hear more about that later in the programme. Thank you, Nick Beek.
A 32-year-old woman is in serious condition after being stabbed at the Notting Hill Carnival, Europe's biggest street festival. Two other men were also stabbed, 15 police officers assaulted and 90 arrests made. Lucy Gray is our reporter in Notting Hill. Good morning, Lucy. What more do we know about the woman's condition?
Hi, Simon. Yes, well, three people stabbed, as you say. So the 32-year-old woman is being treated in hospital and her injuries are life-threatening. Also, a 29-year-old man's also in hospital. His injuries are said to not be life-threatening. And the other man, a 24-year-old man who was stabbed, we haven't been given an update yet on his condition. There were 90 arrests, as you said, relating to a range of offences, including assaulting emergency workers, possession of offensive weapons, drugs, sexual offences, a robbery. The Met Police says that also 15 of their officers were assaulted. None was seriously injured. In terms of their policing operation, it's such a huge operation. This has been planned for many, many months. Earlier there was a Section 60AA was authorised in the carnival area. That means that officers can order people to remove their face coverings and they'll be arrested if they refuse. There was also a general Section 60, which means they have powers to search people. So a huge police presence here. 7,000 officers are going to be deployed in total over the 2 days. I just saw a huge busload of officers arriving to start their shift, just as some of the carnival goers are still making their way home from last night. We've had one officer inspecting our camera equipment just now. So really a huge event, you know, as you were saying, biggest street carnival in Europe, which celebrates Caribbean culture, and a million people are expected over these 2 days to pack the streets full of music and dancing. Hundreds of thousands came yesterday, and the Monday is usually even busier.
Yeah, it was meant to be the family day, is the Sunday, isn't it? The Monday. Actually, typically, it gets a little bit more violent than the Sunday. But Lucy, thanks for that. Lucy Gray there, our reporter in Notting Hill.
The co-founder of one of the UK's biggest sportswear brands has weighed in on the new government's business credentials. Leanna Byrne has that and all the rest of the business news. Good morning, Leanne.
Good morning, Lise. Yes, I've been speaking to Tom Behan. He's a former Tranmere Rovers footballer who, along with his brother Phil, founded Castor in Liverpool back in 2015. And since then, Castor secured high-profile deals with the likes of Sir Andy Murray, the England cricket team, and most recently, Everton Football Club. It's a private company valued at nearly £1 billion. And just last November, the company secured £150 million in investment from US banks and venture capital firms. And Tom Behan was appointed to the former Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Business Council earlier this year. So I asked him for his thoughts on the new Labour government's early days in power.
We're very lucky to have a fantastic Labour mayor here in Greater Manchester. Castor was founded in Liverpool, but we are now based in Manchester. And I think Andy Burnham at a local level has done and continues to do a fantastic job and is very well engaged with the local community overall and the local business community as well. I think certainly at government level, it's fair to say that the jury is still out from a business perspective. So certainly the vast majority of people I speak to, business leaders, founders, CEOs, certainly wish the government the very best and I look forward to seeing how the first 100 days in power play out. But I do also think it's fair to say that there's a level of concern around some of the policies, some of the new deal for workers, some of the conversations on 0-hour contracts, some of the pay increases that have been put through in the public sector. I guess an overall question or concern around the lack of private sector experience in the current cabinet. So that's not to say that they won't do a fantastic job, and I hope that they do. But certainly I think it's still on the new government to prove to business leaders that they don't just say they want to support growth, but that they're implementing policies to drive that as well.
Mm, so just to be clear, you wouldn't necessarily have been in favour of a lot of those policies, like the 0-hour contracts and that you mentioned. happened?
No. So to be clear, very much, I think that they need to be discussed with business leaders to understand businesses' perspective in many cases, if not all. There may well be valid points to each of those policies, but I do think they need to be implemented, having had the proper dialogue with business to understand how they'll impact people on the ground, the risk takers and the wealth creators who are trying to drive growth every day. We need to ensure that their voices are heard.
And what policies would you be looking for, Tom?
So I think certainly as a retail brand, Castor, we founded Castor as a digital first business. The vast majority of our revenue to this day is still generated digitally, but we have significantly invested in the high street. So we now have about 20 physical stores in the UK. We've looked to expand that footprint across Europe, and we'll look to accelerate that in the months and years to come. So like many people, I do believe that the business rates environment is completely antiquated. I think that needs a complete overhaul, not tweaking around the edges. And it would be a very brave government that did that. But I really do think that would supercharge growth on the high street. And then as an entrepreneur, someone that started and built a business, I think the capital gains increase for entrepreneurs, and when that was changed by the previous government, it would be a huge statement of intent from Labour if they reversed that change, and it would really inspire an entrepreneurial generation. So none of those things are easy, and all of them need to be weighed against the broader fiscal environment, of course, but I think there are certainly opportunities for the government to really make a stand in the first 100 days.
So do you think it's a pro-business government?
I think time will tell. So certainly the rhetoric has been positive. I think the Chancellor has demonstrated already that there is a genuine desire to have a strong grip on the public finances, which is very, very important, of course. So that is very positive indeed. But there's a big difference between stability and driving growth. And I'm fortunate that I do travel fairly significantly in my role as founder of Castor. And if I go to places like Dubai, like Singapore, like Tokyo, like New York, it's fair to say that there is a different feel in terms of the entrepreneurial, the dynamism, the approach to business in those countries. So I think a combination of the rhetoric, which has so far been positive, but also the hard policies that underpin that, if the government can really bring those two elements together, then some fantastic things will be done in this country in the coming years.
Tom Behan, co-founder of sportswear brand Castor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate you having me on.
Now, we put Tom Behan's comments to the Department of Business and Trade, which said the government is committed to working in partnership with businesses, including consulting extensively on the New Deal for Working People. OK, the UK markets might be closed, but I'm still joined by Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Good morning, Shanti.
Good morning.
First question for you. We've been hearing about the escalation in tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Has this affected oil prices?
Very little. So oil prices are up slightly, about 0.7% this morning. We've seen throughout the conflict, oil hasn't reacted a lot. And I think part of that's investors being more concerned about, will there be a global slowdown, which would have a much bigger impact on oil demand.
Mm. Another big story over the weekend, global central bank bosses met in Wyoming at the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium. Lots of signs the Federal Reserve is going to bring down its interest rate since UK markets are closed. Global market reaction, any to this?
It was broadly positive. So you saw interest rates on US government bonds fall. You saw the dollar be a little bit weaker, and also equities were up on Friday. I think the main debate in markets is some people are now saying you could have a larger interest rate cut in September, maybe 0.5%. So generally very positively received, but they said they'll be looking at the data and the outlook. The next big data point we'll get is the personal consumption index for the US, which comes out this Friday.
We'll keep an eye on that. Also looking ahead, we've got second quarter earnings from the chip making giant Nvidia. What are you expecting? Because there has been some uncertainty around AI, that industry lately.
Well, I think the worry has been how much some of the other big technology companies are investing and the cost of that. And a lot of that money is actually probably going into Nvidia, as they're a big supplier in that area. So I think there'll be a lot of focus on obviously how much profits they can generate and the outlook. recently we've seen, unless you beat the expectations by a big amount, that you get a bit of a negative reaction. And the other thing for NVIDIA coming up is they've pushed back the development of some of their new line of chips that probably won't change earnings this quarter, but it could influence the estimates for future quarters. A lot of stock prices are based on what are you expecting to earn next year and the year after. So you could see a reaction from the stock if that number goes down as well.
Also, really quickly, CrowdStrike, it's a company many of us really only learned about because of that global Microsoft outage a few weeks ago. They've got results out. What are we expecting?
So they'll probably indicate revenues are going to be a bit lower in the future. The outage we had happened towards the middle of July. So you think about if you're a customer and you're maybe thinking of signing an order or another contract, you might have asked for a discount. You might have delayed your decision to do more due diligence. So the numbers for the last quarter will probably be fairly okay, but they'll probably tell us they're expecting a bit of a fall for the future quarters.
All right, Shanti Kalaban, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the number of people buying houses with help from their families is on the rise, and the amount of people being gifted and the amounts of money being gifted are getting larger. This is according to new research from the financial services company Legal & General. And Bernie Hickman is the Chief Executive of Legal & General Retail. He's with us now. Hi, Bernie.
Good morning, Leanne.
Good morning. Now, we've just been talking about interest rates and the expectation that they'll be going down. Do you think lower interest rates will reduce the need for these financial gifts, or is it just about getting cash for that deposit?
Yeah, well, the lower interest rates obviously is good if you've agreed to buy a property, but and we're seeing more and more people being interested in getting on the property ladder, which is quite understandable. But the what you then expect to happen is with lower interest rates, people could actually afford to pay higher prices, and so we might expect house prices to go up slightly in the future, which is likely to mean that more and more people need support from their family. It hit a record $9.2 billion this year, according to our projections, and is projected to go up to $11.3 billion by 2026. So, yeah, no, I think we're here to see more and more families need to supply some financing and other help to their families. Yeah. Loved ones to get on the property ladder.
Your research found that 42% of home buyers under the age of 55, they're now receiving financial support. There's been a lot more movement in the housing market lately. Is that going to create even more urgency for parents to part with their money to lock in a lower interest rate for their children?
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazingly generous thing that so many families are doing now, and what we're just highlighting that as an issue, and yeah, we're encouraging people, if they can get help from their families, it's a really important thing to do to get on the property ladder. It's important whilst you're working, but it's also got a really important role to play in retirement. If you can ideally own your property when you get to retirement and have paid off the mortgage, that's one massive bill that you don't have to pay in retirement. And then when you're in retirement, it is possible to use some of that housing equity to pay for some of your retirement funding. So, yeah, I would say it's important for people to get on the property ladder if
Bernie,
their families can help them.
Just to come in there, I did notice nearly half of the givers in your research say they feel less financially secure after providing this money. So is it sustainable?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of people are giving, and that giving is having an impact on their own financial situation. It's obviously something that needs to be done really carefully, thought through, ideally take advice. But we and others provide lots of help to help people do it. Inheritance tax would be another thing that needs to be taken account of.
Thank you so much. We'll leave it there. Bernie Hickman, Chief Executive of Legal & General Retail. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you, Leanna. Hear from you after 7 o'clock. Let's get some sport with Sarah Orchard with Sports News. Hi, Sarah.
A very good morning. Well, the post-Jurgen Klopp era at Anfield started with Liverpool recording a 2-0 win over Brentford. After new manager Arne Slot's first home game, he was keen to stress that Liverpool supporters shouldn't expect huge changes in how his side will be going about their business.
The plan doesn't differ that much from the plan that was here 9 years in a row. So we want to work hard. If we don't have the ball, we want to get it back as soon as we can. That was for 9 years Jürgen's style, and that's still our style. And that's logical because many of the same players are there, almost all of them. So it's quite a similar style, and the players are working very hard, and that is always a positive thing to see.
Chelsea thumped Wolverhampton 6-2 away from home. Bournemouth and Newcastle drew. Elsewhere, there were victories in the Scottish Premiership for Celtic, Aberdeen and Motherwell. In golf, New Zealand's Lydia Ko won the Women's Open at St Andrews with a final round 3-under-69. That saw her finish on 7-under-par, one clear of the field. Kat Downs reports.
It was a final day that had everything. Wind, rain, drama. World number one Nelly Korda held a two-shot lead until she double-bogeyed the 14th, and a visit to the infamous roadhole bunker on the 17th marked the end of her challenge. Instead, it was newly minted Olympic champion Lydia Ko who rose to the top with a birdie at the last, and only defending champion Lilia Vu out in the final group could deny the New Zealander her third major title. But Vu bogeyed the 18th, leaving Ko an emotional winner. Her Olympic gold in Paris saw her elevated into the Hall of Fame. At 27, she's hinted she won't play into her 30s. This win at the home of golf will cement her status as one of the greats of the women's game.
England's Lottie Woad won the Smythe Salver as low amateur, birdieing the last to finish on 1-under. Meanwhile, England's Charlie Hull and Ireland's Leona Maguire are among the 8 automatic qualifiers for Europe's Solheim Cup team to face the United States next month. Captain Suzanne Pettersson will name her 4 wildcard picks to make up the 12-strong team later this afternoon. Lando Norris won Formula One's Dutch Grand Prix for McLaren. The Brit finished ahead of home favourite Max Verstappen of Red Bull, while Charles Leclerc came third for Ferrari. And in rugby league, Wigan Warriors are back level on points with Hull KR at the top of the Super League table after beating Hull FC, while Lee Leopards won away at London Broncos.
Thank you, Sarah. Let's see what's happening on our sister station today.
BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates Olivia Colman Day.
She can do anything and everything, and she will.
I'm Carrie-Anne Lloyd, bringing you glorious Olivia Colman performances from the BBC Radio archives. Will we discover some Colman favourites?
Today is a new dawn for Pauline Peeps.
Debut programmes never before heard on Radio 4 Extra.
This is important. No turning back for us now.
Plus, we've got interviews from Olivia's colleagues, fans and friends.
What Olivia can bring is a certain hapless chaos.
Join me, Carrie-Anne Lloyd, for Olivia Colman Day. The celebrations begin this morning from 10 on Radio 4 Extra and BBC Sounds.
It has just gone 6:30. You're listening to Today with Lise Doucette, Simon Jack and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The US says it's working to avert a further escalation of hostilities between Israel and the armed Lebanese group Hezbollah. Yesterday saw the most serious clashes in 10 months of border fighting, with hundreds of rockets and drones fired towards northern Israel by Hezbollah and Israeli forces carrying out heavy airstrikes on southern Lebanon. The Reuters news agency says one of its British employees has been killed in a missile strike on a hotel in eastern Ukraine. Ryan Evans, a safety advisor, was with a reporting team in the city of Kramatorsk, close to the front line. Reuters said two of its journalists were injured, one of them seriously. The messaging app Telegram has insisted its founder, Pavel Durov, has nothing to hide after the Russian-born billionaire was arrested in France. The platform has been accused of failing to cooperate with investigations into drug trafficking, fraud and child sex abuse images. In a statement, Telegram said it was absurd to hold the owner responsible and it abided by all EU laws. Members of the public in England and Wales are being urged to hand in zombie-style knives and machetes before legislation makes them illegal to own later next month. Anonymous surrender bins are being set up at police stations for the next 4 weeks. 3 people were stabbed at the Notting Hill Carnival yesterday. One victim, a 32-year-old woman, is in a life-threatening condition in hospital. The Conservatives have written to the most senior civil servant, the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, demanding to know who authorised a Downing Street pass for the Labour donut Lord Ali. The Sunday Times revealed that the Labour peer had been issued with a pass for number 10, but Downing Street said it had now been handed back. The Conservatives say such passes should be a privilege reserved for those who need access to number 10 for work reasons. And an area of farmland in County Louth near the Irish border is to be searched for the remains of a British soldier murdered by the IRA in 1977. Captain Robert Nerak was working undercover when he was abducted.
Thank you, Alan. It's now 6:33 a.m. and to our story, our first of stories on the Middle East. There are many voices calling for calm, including the UN Secretary General, after yesterday's significant escalation in hostilities between Israel and the Lebanese group Hezbollah. Hezbollah fired hundreds of rockets and drones into Israel, and there were heavy Israeli airstrikes on southern Lebanon. All of this taking place in the midst of the continuing concern of the risk of an all-out war. Let's join our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, in Jerusalem. Yolande, significant hostilities yesterday, but the day seemed to have ended with both sides saying, that's it for now.
Indeed, you had the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying that Israel had ordered this powerful preemptive strike before dawn to eliminate the threat of a mass attack from Hezbollah with rockets and drones. He did warn that what happened was not the final word, but certainly, you know, there does seem to have been a de-escalation from the moment. And we had the Hezbollah leader taking to the TV, Hassan Nasrallah, saying that, you know, basically this reprisal for the assassination of a senior commander, Fuad Shukr, by Israel last month had been completed as planned. He said that, you know, the group would assess the impact of its strikes, and if the result wasn't enough, then it retained the right to respond another time. But he was also telling the people in Lebanon that for now, they can, in his words, take a breath.
When they, as you put it, assess the impact of their strikes, there is this twist in this latest tit for tat that Israel says it preemptively struck. In other words, that it had intelligence that Hezbollah was going to retaliate. Hezbollah denies that. What more do we know?
I mean, we've just had both Israeli and US officials coming out talking about how they gleaned intelligence without giving too much detail. These signs that Hezbollah was preparing to launch this significant missile and drone attack, and that led some 100 Israeli warplanes then to take this preemptive action, attacking launch sites in the south of Lebanon. We know, of course, that not all of those drones and missiles were prevented. According to Israeli media, they think that the strike destroyed about 2/3 of the rockets Hezbollah had planned to fire at Israel, but still more than 300 went through. And there's a lot of commentary in the Israeli media this morning that how what's happened hasn't really changed the strategic situation in the north of Israel. And this is where, of course, you have tens of thousands of citizens displaced by the fighting, which has been going on with Hezbollah since back in October. You have a similar number of citizens who are displaced on the Lebanese side, but there is a lot of domestic pressure for things to change in Israel, for Hezbollah to be dealt with so that people can return to their homes.
Yolande Nell, thank you. And that's, of course, the proverbial fog of war. We'll try to clear some of it again at 8:10 with our senior international correspondent, Orly Geerin, and the former head of MI6, John Soares.
If you own a zombie knife, now is the time to hand it in. An amnesty and compensation scheme for people in England and Wales who surrender them starts today, ahead of a ban that comes into force next month. Mark Easton is our home editor. Morning, Mark. How's this going to work?
Well, this is really a bit of housekeeping in a way, because Parliament tried to ban these, you know, horrible-looking knives back in 2016, but they drew the definition quite tightly. They had to have distinct images or threatening words that incited violence. So now the new law, which comes in on the 24th of September, will ban any knife that has a plain cutting edge, a sharp pointed edge, and a blade of over 8 inches long. And it also has to have a sort of serrated cutting edge, more than one hole, spikes, and more than two sharp points in the blade. It's got one of those details, then it becomes one of these banned knives. So it's a bit complicated. Mm-hmm. But what they've done is they've increased the range of knives that are now essentially illegal, or will be essentially illegal, to possess, sell, manufacture or transport, and all kinds of knives are in that. You mentioned zombie knives, so that the legislation talks about zombie style knives and machetes, but there's a whole range of knives, some of which people collect, some of which people have for very legitimate reasons, maybe in forestry or museums and so on. So the government is saying, right, for the next month, between now and the 24th of September, you can hand them into police stations without fear of prosecution. And in some cases, actually, you'll be able to get compensation. So it's basically, sometimes some of these blades are worth a lot of money, in which case, you know, if you can prove that, the Home Office will give you that money back. But normally you won't have that. However, they say if you have three knives, which do apply, you can get £10 for each of those because the minimum claim is 30 quid. So three knives and, yeah, you get 30 quid.
And just this obviously in a battle against knife crime, is there evidence that these kind of knives are more prevalent in that kind of crime? And do people really think that people are going to wander down to the local police station and hand over a weapon like this, where people might fear they get on some sort of list or even have their fingerprints taken?
Well, on the second point, I think the police are absolutely clear. There have been many knife amnesties and so forth over the years. The police are absolutely clear that those people who do take part in this amnesty, no action will be taken against them. There'll be no use of CCTV or anything like that. So people can be assured that that won't happen. Although I take your point that I think for an awful lot of people, the idea of kind of people who might own one of these knives, the idea of going into a police station and quietly putting it in a bin probably doesn't appeal. In terms of their use more generally, the vast majority of knife crime involves kitchen knives. I mean, things out of a drawer. That's the thing. What these knives tend to be used for is what they're called statement weapons by gangs. So we've been quite successful in getting guns off the streets of Britain over the years. So if you are a criminal gangster and you want to just spread fear and alarm, having a really, really fearsome looking blade that you can pull out, that is a statement. And that's really what the government is trying to do here, is trying to take weapons which have no purpose really beyond just terrorizing people, get those off the streets, get them up so you can't sell them, you can't make them, you can't transport them.
Great. All right, Mark, thanks for that. Mark Easton there.
So, is it Glasses Gate, or as the Daily Mail puts it, the passes for glasses sleaze row? The Conservatives are demanding to know who authorised a Downing Street pass for Labour's biggest donor, Lord Waheed Ali, as reported in the Sunday Times. Well, Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is here. Now, Henry, you've reported before on the questions being raised about jobs in the government. Is this, I hesitate to say just about a pass, but this is very much focused on a pass.
It is. This is about Lord Ali, Waheed Ali. He's donated £500,000 to Labour over decades and made large donations personally to Keir Starmer, notably, as you mentioned, those rather swanky new pairs of glasses which he got just before the general election. Now, it transpired at the weekend, the Sunday Times revealed, that he held for a time a Downing Street pass and helped to organise a post-election reception in the No. 10 garden. He's understood to have given it back a few weeks ago, though it doesn't expire until the end of the month. Now, Downing Street has given no public account of what role he held that required essentially unmediated access to the Downing Street estate. That's what you get with a pass. It's understood he took part in some post-election political meetings, i.e. not with civil servants. You don't necessarily need a pass for that. And that's why the Conservatives have written to Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, saying that he should investigate because they say a pass should be a privilege reserved for those that require access for work, not for those who need occasional access.
Is this going to stick?
Well, interestingly, over the weekend, I spoke to some allies of the Prime Minister who say, look, the fact that he had a pass is not really consequential. He wasn't doing very much. But they do believe or fear that to the public, it is quite a bad look. And it comes in the background, as you mentioned, of a row over civil service jobs. You know, another Labour donor was given a temporary job in the Treasury, though he's now going to do it as an unpaid advisor. A couple of other Labour adjacent figures were given civil service jobs. Now, you can find precedents for most of these things, examples where previous governments have been accused of malpractice over appointments, over staffing. But I think the political risk for Keir Starmer is that he, distinctively compared to other prime ministers, was elected in part on a push to clear that sort of stuff up. And I think the risk for him is that to the extent this row cuts through to the public, they conclude he's not as different as they hoped.
Yes, and just very briefly, it's not just one pair of glasses, it's glasses in the plural. And there are reports of suits, Taylor Swift tickets? What is confirmed as far as you know?
Well, actually, the donations in kind of clothes from Lord Ali, those were in the public domain before. I think the Taylor Swift tickets, if I remember rightly, were donated to Keir Starmer by an organisation rather than Lord Ali. But all of this, these questions that will hang, for example, over a big speech that Keir Starmer's giving tomorrow, a fairly gloomy speech about what he says is the rubble and ruin left by his predecessors. You know, there is just that risk that he gets waylaid when he's asked questions afterwards about these sorts of questions. And those are questions that bogged down previous governments. He had hoped to be different.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
Talking about Taylor Swift tickets, what about Oasis tickets? Because if you look on the papers this morning, you'll see from the front of the Sun the two Gallagher brothers, Noel and Liam, in a sort of embrace with fist in the air, saying after 15 years looking back in anger, Noel and Liam end feud in phone call and reform. The headline says definitely no maybes. They're also on the front page of the Mirror, and it's going to be a very lucrative tour, we think. If they have not yet confirmed it, but everyone, the Sun looks very confident that it's going to happen. And the Mail rather mischievously speculates that Noel Gallagher's £20 million divorce might be one of the reasons behind a lucrative tour revival.
Well, the papers I'm looking at, Simon, the Mirror has alarming headline, brink of war, Israeli blitz after Hezbollah strike sparks new fears. It said last night the fears of an all-out war in the Middle East were growing after Israel launched huge airstrikes on Hezbollah in Lebanon. The Financial Times puts it in this way, stakes raised, Hezbollah and Israel clash. There's another picture of another dramatic picture of a Hezbollah drone being destroyed by the Israeli Air Force over northern Israel. The headline in the Daily Telegraph, Netanyahu, this is not end of story.
And the I newspaper carries on about the disquiet in some Labour ranks about the winter fuel allowance cut that Rachel Reeves announced. They're saying concerns are growing in the Cabinet over the Chancellor's decision to cut the allowance payments. MPs say the issue is coming up on the doorstep and in emails and letters, and a lot of very frightened people worry about rising costs this winter. They have a quote here saying there's a lot of bad feeling about the decision. One MP said, well, a minister's called on the Chancellor to show some flexibility on it. Now, our main story this morning is there have been international calls for restraint after Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began.
An update now on the Mpox story. Health workers in the worst affected country, the Democratic Republic of Congo, have told the BBC more than 70% of the people being treated at their clinics have been children under the age of 10. The BBC has been given exclusive access to two treatment centres in the east of the country. That's the epicentre of this latest Mpox outbreak. Our Africa correspondent, Simi Jola Oso, has this report. It was gathered for the BBC inside the DRC by a local journalist.
Children at this hospital in Kavumu in South Kivu appear weary and in pain. This includes two-year-old Ansima, who caught Mpox from one of her five siblings, who have all had the disease. Her mother, Inzigire Kanigo, had no idea what it was.
This is the first time I've seen it. When my child got sick, other parents told me it might be measles. But we started treating measles and failed, so we decided to come here. Three are cured and they're at home. I only have two who I am admitted with now in this hospital. I thank God.
Doctors at this hospital say there's been high demand for beds and medicines, but not enough supply. It's had 800 Mpox patients since June. More than 70% have been children. Eight have died, all under the age of five. About 100 miles away, in the treatment centre in Munigi near Goma, six-year-old Amani skips around his room.
Amani.
He is finally recovering from Mpox after 4 days of free treatment. His father, Alen Mataboro, describes what it was like.
It began like a small inflamed spot. The mother squeezed it and watery discharge came out. Then another developed, and after a short period, they were all over.
Like the hospital, three quarters of patients here have been under the age of 10. Dr. Pierre Olivier Ngajole, who works for the charity Medair, told the BBC they've had up to 10 new cases a day.
The IDP camps are overcrowded. So you see children in the IDP camps, they are always playing together. They don't really care about social distance. They don't care about that. And you can also see, like, in the household, they even pass the night on the same bed. You can find three, four, five children. So the contact is very so close and is very permanent. So that means the transmission is really present on day basis.
This region in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo is filled with millions of people who have been displaced because of an ongoing armed conflict. They can be crammed in makeshift structures at camps where the living conditions are often poor and lack good sanitation, the perfect place for mpox to run rampant. Charity workers are trying to get ahead by teaching people about symptoms, stigma, and hygiene. The message resonates with some at Muja Camp in Nyiragongo, but it doesn't suppress their fear.
We have been sensitized, but we are full of fear because we are crowded in our shelters, we sleep in very poor conditions, we share beddings, so prevention is difficult. And because of that, we are afraid.
We have children in the house. Tell our leaders to send us medicine, soaps, and other protective measures so that we don't get infected.
The government is hopeful mpox vaccinations will begin this week, with children first in line. But the incessant conflict will pose a challenge.
Sissy Joloso there reporting from the DRC. The time is 10 to 7. Now, there have been more than 100 people have been evacuated from a building partly used as a block of flats in East London, which has been engulfed in flames. Our reporter Simon Jones is in Dagenham. And Simon, I've seen some of the pictures, quite a substantial fire.
Yeah, and it's very much ongoing this morning. I'm overlooking the block of flats and smoke is emanating from the roof. In the past few minutes, I saw flames licking up. We've got firefighters using those high-rise ladders, spraying water onto the top of the building. Now, we were told that the fire broke out just after 2:30 this morning. 100 people, as you say, were evacuated from the building. We've just heard from London Ambulance Service. They treated 4 people, and 2 of those have been taken to hospital. We're not sure yet whether everyone has been accounted for, but certainly searches are ongoing. The firefighting operation is ongoing, and as far as I can see in the street, there are fire engines, 40, tackling this blaze, and ambulances along the side road. Certainly a big operation, a big fire prompting a huge response.
And do we have any idea of the cause of the fire?
We don't at the moment. That will be part of the investigation. What we do know is that they were in the process of replacing on the side of the building cladding, which was considered to be non-compliant, and replacing that with compliant material. That's why there was scaffolding on the building. So that will certainly be part of the investigation, whether it was anything to do with that. Now, I understand there are around 60 flats in this building, but it's also got a commercial use as well, because on the ground floor is a nursery, and that has been affected, we're told, by the fire. And all parts of the building, all 6 floors, have been affected in some way. I just spoke to one man whose daughter was in the building overnight. Obviously, a frightening experience for her, having to leave the building at 2:45 in the morning. Now, people who have been unable to go to friends or relatives have been taken to a nearby sports centre, but certainly firefighters still struggling to bring this blaze under control. It's very much an ongoing operation this morning.
Simon, thank you. Simon Jones there in Dagenham. If we get more information on that, we will bring it to you.
To another way in which artificial intelligence is changing our lives, data scientists and clinical researchers in Scotland are now hoping to use AI to predict a person's risk of dementia. Professor Will Whiteley, who's the co-lead of what's called the ScanDan project at the University of Edinburgh's Centre for Clinical Brain Sciences, joins us. Professor Whiteley, tell us more about this idea. Will it be that AI you'll use AI to look at a person's brain scan and be able to say with some certainty but whether or not they'll be able to they will develop dementia?
Yes, well, that's the hope. As we're developing new treatments for dementia, we really need to identify people at risk. Currently, that's very intensive and the scans used are quite costly. So if we can reduce the cost to identify people at higher risk using artificial intelligence like this project, we'll hope to speed up the testing of treatments over the years to come to really face what's going to be a major challenge for us as a country, the challenge of the number of people developing dementia.
And with this additional information, what impact would that have on the care of people?
So what we'd like to do is to find those people who are at highest risk and then invite them to take part in studies of new treatments. So there's hope for new treatments. There's 127 drugs currently in clinical trials, but we need to get those trials to work as quickly as possible. So if we can identify people at risk using scans they have as part of their routine care in the NHS, we hope that we'll be able to deliver those drugs to patients. And hopefully some of them will work to prevent or treat dementia.
And will this be widely available?
Well, what we hope to do is to make this as cheap and widely available as possible by integrating this artificial intelligence into the usual care of brain scans taken in clinical practice. And that's why we've got this collaboration between UK universities, Dundee and Edinburgh, and funders, and the Healthcare Data Research UK, which is the UK's health data charity.
So at what stage is this? Is this development? Will you be starting to use it, or is it still in the development phase?
Well, we've started to try and develop our algorithms. We're really at the earliest stages, working in partnership with Public Health Scotland, and scans taken as part of people's routine care. We've got about 1.6 million scans. So we've got a really great opportunity to provide these digital biomarkers for new trials in the United Kingdom.
And of course, not enough is yet known about artificial intelligence, its weaknesses and strengths. Do you see other ways in which it could be possibly helpful in this area?
Well, we use artificial intelligence every day in the NHS. It's used for the care of people with stroke. And we hope that it'll be used for the care of people with dementia as well as many other conditions. And of course, the reading and analyzing of scans is a really important part where artificial intelligence might be able to contribute to care. So I think over the coming years, we'll really see it coming into routine practice in the NHS in many areas.
And of course, for most people, it will be not just knowing it might happen, but stopping it from happening. As you mentioned, there are those clinical trials now taking place. It seems that in many areas, artificial intelligence is really speeding up what have been really areas of research for a very long time.
Yeah, I think so. You know, the ability to analyze very large, complicated data sets is something that's really ideal for artificial intelligence applications. And it's used throughout medicine, from drugs discovery to the delivery of care. And there's really fantastic centres of excellence in the United Kingdom. And with what the care provided by the NHS, we've got really great opportunities in this country to really deliver on artificial intelligence to improve the care of people affected by all sorts of conditions.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that, Professor Will Whiteley.
I don't know. AI is going to either kill us all, cure us all, and means we can't believe anything we read, see, or hear ever again. Let's get some weather. We can believe Thomas Schaffernacker. He had some good news for us in the last hour.
Yeah, I tell you what, AI is after my job as well. That's for sure.
Oh, no.
pretty good at it, though. Pretty good.
How can you replace Thomas Schaffernacker?
Oh, thank you, Liz. Thank you. So what have we got in store today? Well, we're actually waking up to some pleasant sunshine now across many eastern parts of England, the Midlands, the south of England too, just scattered clouds here and there. But it's a slightly different story at the moment in Northern Ireland, Western Scotland, and particularly around Cumbria, Lancashire. Pretty overcast here and some outbreaks of rain. So certainly not wall-to-wall sunshine at the moment across the UK. But I have got some good news for you where it's cloudy and drizzly at the moment. The chances are that as we go through the morning into the afternoon, the clouds will break up. And I think come the middle of the afternoon, generally speaking across the UK, It's a day of sunny spells. Some areas will have a little more sunshine than others, but overall, a pleasant Monday on the way. Now, temperatures today will range from around 17 degrees for our friends in the Western Isles of Scotland, 18 or 19 in the lowlands of Scotland, around that also in the northwest of England, and the warmer spots will be in the Midlands, the south and the southeast. Temperatures are expected to reach the low 20s, and I think it's going to be a fine day on the south coast of England as well. In fact, clear blue skies looking out to sea. Tonight, rain is expected to sweep into northwestern areas of the UK, which means that tomorrow is going to be a bit of a mixed bag. We've rain across many western parts of the UK, but it will be very warm and sunny across East Anglia and the southeast, with temperatures hitting the mid-20s. That's it. You're up to date.
Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. Coming up in the next hour, we will we'll have that after that exchange of heavy fire between Israel and Hezbollah. We'll cross live to Beirut. We'll also be discussing why the chief executive of the messaging app Telegram has been arrested, and we'll also be talking about the possible reunion, definitely maybe, of Oasis. We'll get the thoughts of Steve Lamacq and Miranda Sawyer on that. What else have you got coming up, Lise?
Well, we're going to, well, of course, you seem to be very, very interested in what's Oasis. Happening with Oasis. But we have other kinds of music, too, because we're going to look at the proms taking place, special BBC proms taking place in Bristol, and a focus on classical music for children.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Lise Doucette and me, Simon Jack. All of that coming up in the next hour on the Today programme. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 26th of August. The headlines this morning. The US says it's working to prevent the conflict between Israel and the armed Lebanese group Hezbollah spiralling into a regional war after yesterday's escalation of hostilities. A British man working for the Reuters news agency has died after a missile strike on a hotel in eastern Ukraine. And a month-long amnesty for owners of zombie-style knives is beginning in England and Wales. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres said he's deeply concerned after Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. The US says it's working to avoid a further escalation in hostilities, and Britain has urged all parties in the region to show restraint. Yesterday, Israel carried out airstrikes on dozens of sites in southern Lebanon in what it said was a preemptive attack. And Hezbollah launched hundreds of rockets and drones towards northern Israel. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell has sent this report from Jerusalem.
While Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon appear to have paused hostilities, tensions remain dangerously high, triggering international calls for restraint. There are reports of diplomatic efforts through intermediaries to try to contain the situation. In a televised speech, the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah told Lebanon it could take a breath after his group completed its revenge attack for a top commander killed in an Israeli airstrike last month. And US and Israeli officials gave further details of how intelligence had detected signs that Hezbollah was preparing to launch a major missile and drone attack, leading Israeli warplanes to take preemptive action before dawn yesterday. Mediators say that the dramatic attacks have not derailed talks on a Gaza ceasefire, which have been taking place in Cairo, though so far there's been no sign of a breakthrough.
The news agency Reuters has confirmed that a British man who was working as a safety advisor in eastern Ukraine has been killed in a missile strike on a hotel. Ryan Evans, who was 38, was part of a team that was reporting on the war. From Ukraine, here's our correspondent Nick Beek.
Reuters announced that they were devastated at Ryan Evans's death. They said the former British soldier had helped many of their journalists cover events around the world and that he would be tremendously missed. Mr. Evans was killed and two other colleagues injured after a missile hit their hotel in the city of Kramatorsk, which is under Ukrainian control but close to the front line. President Zelensky sent his condolences, concluding, "This is the daily Russian terror that continues." Moscow has not commented on the strike. This morning, all of Ukraine has been under air raid alert, with more Russian missiles reported to have been fired at a number of regions. There have been explosions in the city of Kharkiv in the northeast, Dnipro in the east, and Melnitsky in the west. In the capital, Kyiv, air defences could be heard attempting to intercept incoming fire.
The messaging app Telegram has condemned the arrest in France of its billionaire founder, Pavel Durov. It said it was absurd that its owner, who was born in Russia, was being held responsible for abuses on the platform. Simon Jones reports.
Pavel Durov was arrested when his private jet landed at an airport on the outskirts of Paris on Saturday. He's reportedly been accused of not doing enough to curb criminal activity on his messaging app. Telegram has allegedly failed to cooperate with investigations into drug trafficking, child sex abuse images and fraud. But in a statement, the company insisted that its moderation met industry standards. It said that Mr. Durov had nothing to hide, adding, "It is absurd to claim that a platform or its owner are responsible for abuse of that platform." The French authorities can hold Mr. Durov for up to 96 hours.
An amnesty and compensation scheme for people in England and Wales who possess zombie-style knives and machetes starts today, ahead of the weapons being banned next month. New legislation will make it an imprisonable offence to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives favoured by criminal gangs. More details from our home editor Mark Easton.
Zombie knives, Rambo knives, serrated, long-bladed machetes, weapons designed to intimidate and terrorise. The government tried a ban in 2016, but a loophole meant some items bypassed the rule. Ahead of the legislation coming into force on the 24th of September, people who currently legally possess such knives can hand them into police stations without fear of prosecution, and in some cases claim compensation. Three zombie-style knives would be worth at least £30 under the scheme. There are exemptions for people who have good reason to own the items, for example, a specialist machete used in forestry or an antique samurai sword, but people who do own long-bladed weapons are advised to check with their local police on whether they fall foul of the law.
A 32-year-old woman is in a life-threatening condition in hospital after being stabbed at the Notting Hill Carnival in West London. Two men, aged 24 and 29, were also treated for knife wounds. The main carnival parade takes place later today. The Conservatives have written to the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case, demanding to know who authorised a Downing Street pass for the Labour donor Lord Ali. The Sunday Times revealed that the Labour peer had been issued with a pass for number 10, but Downing Street said it had now been handed back. The Conservatives say it's deeply concerning it was issued at all. More details from our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The Shadow Cabinet Office Minister, John Glenn, has written to the country's most senior civil servant to inquire whether the Prime Minister or his Chief of Staff, the former civil servant Sue Gray, had requested the pass for Lord Ali. The Labour peer has raised substantial funds for the party and donated to individual politicians, including Sir Keir Starmer when he was leader of the opposition. The Conservatives are keen to dent Labour's claim to be a sleaze-busting government of service. Mr Glenn argues that passes should be a privilege, reserved for those who need access to number 10 for work reasons, such as civil servants and advisers, and not party donors. Downing Street confirmed that Lord Ali did have a pass, but it was temporary and given back several weeks ago. A number 10 source also confirmed that he'd held the pass when he attended a post-election reception in the Downing Street garden, but wouldn't say why he was given the pass or why it was then given up.
More than 100 people have been evacuated from a building in East London, partly used as a block of flats, after a fire broke out in the early hours. More than 200 firefighters are at the scene in Dagenham. Two people have been taken to hospital. The Lib Dems have raised concerns about the amount of sewage being released near England's Blue Flag beaches. They say analysis of Environment Agency data shows 2,320 such cases last year, a rise of more than 50% compared with 2022. The top five worst affected blue flag beaches for sewage discharges were all in Devon. New legislation has come into force in Australia, offering relief to millions of workers who feel obliged to take calls or read messages from their employers after they've finished their day's work. The Right to Disconnect law aims to redress the work-life balance by allowing workers to ignore after-hours communications if they choose to, without fear of being punished by their employers. Rachel Abdelnour, who works in the advertising industry, welcomed the changes.
We spend so much of our time connected to our phones, connected to our emails all day. And I think that it's really hard to switch off as it is. So having these laws come into place where we really do disconnect is really important, especially like in my life where I have external clients who need to get a hold of me. We don't always have the same working hours.
There's growing speculation that an Oasis reunion could finally be about to happen. Both Noel and Liam Gallagher have teased a possible announcement, as Chris Berrow reports.
Fans have been hoping for years that the warring Gallagher brothers might end their 15-year feud and take to the stage together again. The Sunday Times reported yesterday that the brothers were set to perform a series of gigs next year. There's speculation this could include a headline slot at Glastonbury. To add to the expectation, Liam Gallagher dedicated the Oasis track Half the World Away to his brother during his set at Reading Festival last night. And on Instagram, both brothers have posted a clip of a sign in the style of the Oasis logo. Tomorrow's date is written in the middle, which then changes to 8 a.m, suggesting an announcement could be imminent.
That report was from Chris Berrow.
And that was Alan Smith with the latest news. It's now 7:09. So far, all quiet on the Lebanon-Israel front this morning, after yesterday's significant escalation, but the risk remains. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel's airstrikes were not the end of the story. And the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech last night that its military operations were finished for the day. But Hezbollah is indicating this may just be the beginning of its retaliation for Israel's killing of its senior commander, Fuad Shukr, last month in Beirut. So what could be next? Let's go to Beirut now to join Fadi Nicholas Nassar. He's in Beirut. He's the U.S.-Lebanon Fellow at the Middle East Institute, as well as the Director for the Institute for Social Justice and Conflict Resolution at the Lebanese American University. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you assess what Hezbollah was trying to achieve yesterday, and did it succeed?
Look, it's a great question. It's a bit early to tell. You know, as you noted, Hezbollah has on the what's going to come next. It has noted on the one hand and kept the door open that this may be the first phase of what may come. But the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, has indicated in his last speech that this was an effort to sort of strike at the intelligent capacities of Israel. But, you know, after days and days and weeks of sort of signaling a strong response was coming against Israel, the mood has been that this has sort of fallen short, and certainly Israel has picked up on this by sort of signaling, you know, quite explicitly that it has taken preemptive actions to thwart a larger Hezbollah response.
The commander who was killed, Fuad Shukr, was said to have been very close to Hassan Nasrallah, possibly his closest commander. Was there pressure on Hezbollah to be seen to be doing something?
Definitely. What I would, you know, encourage your audience to remember is that what we've really been seeing since October last year, when Hezbollah opened a limited front with Israel in support of its ally Hamas, is that there's been a struggle between Hezbollah and more broadly Iran and Israel over redefining this strategic balance and the rules of engagement that have governed the Lebanon-Israel conflict since 2006. Now, the assassination you mentioned of one of Hezbollah's most senior military leaders in Beirut, which was a previous red line of those rules of engagement, you know, strongly demonstrate that Israel's escalatory dominance.
The line is wobbling a bit, but I'm just going to see if I can ask on her. There was a sense, as you know, Fadi, that Iran, Hezbollah and Iran were delaying their retaliation so as not to jeopardize the ceasefire talks in Gaza. Hezbollah obviously decided it could still carry out an attack and not put those talks at risk.
So, from what I understand of the question about the impact this may have on ceasefire negotiations, you know, as I noted early on, we have, you know, Hezbollah has kept the door a bit open to the potential for a larger response. At the same time, it's important for us to recall that Iran has not yet implemented or taken its response to the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. Now, certainly the argument they are presenting as these negotiations are ongoing is that this is to increase leverage for Hamas in the ongoing negotiations.
Well, we'll soon find out. Fadi Nicholas Nassar in Beirut. Thank you.
13 minutes past seven. There's been a huge rise in the number of sewage discharges near so-called Blue Flag beaches. Blue Flag's an international award presented to well-managed beaches with good water quality. In 2023, there were 2,328 discharges. That's a 55% increase on the previous year. That's according to analysis of Environment Agency data by the Liberal Democrats. Wendy Chamberlain is a spokesman for the Lib Dems and is on the line. Good morning to you, Wendy Chamberlain.
Good morning,
Simon. It just seems such an enormous increase. One wonders whether these are actual poorer performance by the water companies, or in fact we're just watching for these discharges more. Are we actually monitoring it more closely and that is part of the reason?
Well, one of the things the water companies say is that they are monitoring, but certainly what they don't seem to be doing is reducing. And as you rightly say, this is an internationally recognised award, having a blue flag beach. It's about something wider than sewage, but it does feel that those beaches are being let down by the number of discharges. But you're right to say that this has become something that's been politically of more interest in the last couple of years, particularly when people are starting to become ill and we're seeing more general discharges in waterways. What we want to see now from the government as Liberal Democrats is the commitment to get on and doing something about this, tackling it with the water companies, but also ensuring that swimmers and people enjoying themselves over the bank holidays know that this internationally recognised award actually means something when they visit our beaches.
Well, if these sewage discharges are happening so close to the blue flag beaches, aren't those very blue flags in danger of being, you know, if you like, lifted or withdrawn?
Absolutely. Exmouth Beach is a good example where actually the flag recently had to be taken down for a week until the worst of the sewage has passed. If those become increasingly frequent, then the award loses its value and becomes meaningless. Mm. That's why it's so important that we need to do something about it.
And what exactly are you calling? What exactly are you calling for? Because obviously there's a private water companies, you've got an agency, you've got Ofwat there, you've got DEFRA, the government, for example, say the new government will never look the other way while water companies pump record levels of sewage into our rivers, lakes and seas.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Prime Minister is appearing today where apparently the message is that things are going to get worse before they get better. And when it comes to sewage, this isn't just about people enjoying those spaces, but it's about the wider environmental damage. You know, the Liberal Democrats were the first party to be talking about this. We've obviously made gains down in the southwest, and some of that is because of our message in relation to this issue is cutting through. We've said that we think Ofwat needs to be scrapped. We've said that we want to ensure that these discharges are reduced, and we want to see the plans from the water company to do so and to hold them to account. And finally, you know, we do want to see these big water companies stop paying the large amounts of bonuses that they are to their staff whilst such incidents are happening.
Yeah, I mean, the government has said that under the Water Special Measures Bill, law-breaking water bosses could face criminal charges and a ban on their bonuses if they don't clean up their act. So DEFRA are acting.
Yeah, they are beginning to act. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I would argue that's because it has become such a political issue. But those factors such as criminal charges, etc., don't get away from the fact that here we are on a bank holiday weekend and we cannot say with all confidence that our blue flag beaches are not being damaged by sewage outflows.
OK, Wendy Chamberlain, we'll leave it there. Thank you. Wendy Chamberlain, Liberal Democrat spokesperson.
Well, we are being told that we are now in the last bank holiday before Christmas. I mean, we're already being reminded about Christmas. But business do think about it because they are counting on some sunny skies to boost those numbers. Leanna Byrne is back to find out how the weather is playing out for the economy over this weekend.
Hi, Lise. Yeah, sorry about talking about Christmas, but going into the bank holiday, data from Experian estimated that we could see an extra £600 million pumped into the UK economy. But that was very much contingent on the weather being nice. And I think it's fair to say it hasn't exactly been a scorcher. I'm joined by Julie Dalton, Managing Director at Gulliver's Theme Parks and Resorts. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
Julie, let's be honest, theme parks are a lot more fun when the sun is out. How's business been at Gulliver's this weekend?
Well, very much as you said, the weather has played the cards again. Yes, we haven't had a great weekend just because the weather hasn't been with us. You know, our southern theme parks have been better than our northern ones because the weather has been better. But yes, the weather forecast and the weather have not helped us this weekend.
Yeah, when the weather's not on your side, what can you do?
Well, actually, from a visitor experience point of view, you get a much better day if on your little iPhone you've got the little rain symbol. Actually, the parks tend to be quieter, so the visitor experience is much, much better on a wet day than it is on
no
a dry
queues,
day.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's been a challenge this year from start to finish. It's been one of those roller coaster rides. On the few very nice days we've had, the parks have been very busy. On the probably majority of the days when the weather hasn't been great, we have been quieter than normal.
Mm. Julie, how important is the summer season for you financially? Because we are going into the autumn now.
The summer season is absolutely critical for us. You know, those 6 weeks of the children's holidays represent about a third of our turnover. So, yeah, very, very important to us. And the summer hasn't actually been that bad. We've not had that many wet days over the kids' holidays. But, you know, it is just one of our periods that, you know, do make or break a season. But it's been pre that's been really, really critical. And with the cost of living that we're seeing at the moment, actually, that value message has been really important to our guests.
Mm, of course, yeah. I mean, the rate of inflation has slowed since where we were this time last year. But as you said, people are still feeling stretched. Are you seeing that play out in how your visitors are spending?
Yeah, we have. You know, we've had to do an awful lot of work. You know, we very much are that value proposition. So, you know, for us, a stay at our parks, if you're coming for 2 days and an overnight, we now include food with that as well. So it's not fully inclusive, but it's most of your costs are there. And for £250, you can do that. And that has been incredibly popular this year. But we do see the number of people that are bringing their picnics this year has increased on last year, which always for us is a sign that actually pennies might be a little bit tighter at home.
And what does that do to your bottom line very quickly, Julie? Because if people aren't, you know, spending as much, what's your investment like?
Well, we have to keep pushing forward. You know, theme parks thrive on new activities, new ways of running. And, you know, we're working really, really hard at that. You know, mm-hmm. we still have Christmas to come. You know, I know you just mentioned Christmas. Well,
yep.
You know, we are into that booking of our Christmas season, our fireworks season. We have our Land of Lights, all of which we invest in heavily because it does just take that emphasis off that whole 6 weeks process. So,
okay.
Yeah, very much pushing forward.
All right. Julie Dalton, Managing Director at Gulliver's Theme Parks and Resorts. Thank you for joining us.
And Leanna, good luck with that Christmas shopping this weekend. Now, if you were listening on Saturday morning, and we hope you were, we spoke about a special BBC Proms this bank holiday weekend, not at the Royal Albert Hall, but in Bristol, hosted by the Bristol Beacon. It's offering a special programme of events, including a musical ocean adventure for the whole family. CBB's friends Jojo and Gran-Gran are on board the Bristol Beacon submarine. To give you a flavour of what's in store, this was the ocean adventure at the 2022 CBB's Proms. And that was conducted by Kwame Ryan, who's the conductor for today's CBB's Prom in Bristol. He's also the music director of Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, North Carolina, USA. Kwame Ryan, I understand this is your third year of doing this CBB's Proms. What are you learning about what works best for children and indeed for the entire family?
Well, when you're trying to introduce very young children to the instruments of the orchestra and you know how music is performed live, it's best we've found to take a rather indirect route, which involves storytelling, which involves, you know, integrating the sounds of the instruments in the environment that the story takes place in, the sounds that populate the story, the actions and colors, so that it's a more associative and sort of interactive experience than just a pedagogical one.
Is it, you know, just listening to that excerpt that we heard, there's a lovely flow in it. You can actually feel like you're in the water.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the tricks that we use. Children are very attuned to, you know, sounds and sights and feelings, and they're curious. So we try and make the music that we choose as evocative as possible so that they can imagine a situation or an animal or a color or a feeling when they hear the music. And that way it sort of comes to life to them more than it would if they just knew this was the sound of a clarinet or the sound of a violin.
And are there other aspects to think about, Kwame, when you're doing not live performing, but a television program too?
Well, I mean, it's a very technical exercise. Performing for television is certainly the way we do it, very scripted. Everything is planned out to time. And in the development process, you know, we're looking at the sort of energy map of the whole show because, you know, we're dealing with very small children who have short attention span. So all of that is planned out to keep their interest, well, to get their interest in the first place and then hold it for an hour.
And each time you've done it, there has been a theme. I understand the first one was the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And this is, of course, all about not just the ocean, but about valuing the planet. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, certainly as long as I've been doing the CBBS proms, there has been a strong focus on nature and on the value of the planet and looking after it. So whether we were, you know, going to the moon, as you mentioned, and looking back at planet Earth and understanding how rare and valuable it is, or going the other direction, as we will today, into the depths of the ocean and understanding how, you know, endangered some of the ocean species are just because of the way humans, you know, pollute and, you know, have disregard for the, you know, for the how clean the water needs to be for the animals to survive. We're always trying to, you know, instill those kinds of values in children, but always in the context of a story and always underscored with exciting music.
Kwame Ryan, thank you very much for bringing us into your world. I have to tell you that many of the people in the studio are waiting for the Oasis reunion, but I hope they're also going to take time to either on CBBS or indeed at the Bristol Beacon. Thank you so much. I hope it goes very well.
Peter and the Wolf is the one I remember.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. They, remember Peter and the Wolf? They had all the different instruments for different things. They used to play that a lot when I was a kid. Anyway, let's get some sport. Sarah Orchard is back. Hi, Sarah.
Yeah, good morning again. New Zealand's Lydia Ko has won the final women's golf major of the year. The Women's Open at St Andrews, of course. Her final round of 3-under-69 saw her finish on 7-under-par, one clear of the field and picking up a cheque worth £1 million. It's Ko's third major win and comes just a matter of weeks after she took Olympic gold in Paris.
It's pretty surreal, you know, winning the gold medal in Paris a couple weeks ago. How is it possible for me to win the AIG Women's Open? You know, I've had the most Cinderella-like story this past few weeks.
Well, she had to do it the hard way. There were high winds throughout, particularly the first couple of rounds. We're joined by BBC golf correspondent Ian Carter, who also braved the elements at St Andrews. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Sarah.
Just how dramatic was that final round? And is Nelly Korda ultimately left wondering what if?
I think it was an absolute thriller. A clutch of world number ones, past and present, battling it out down the most famous stretch of closing holes in the game. Korda will rue an awful double bogey on the 14th, no doubt about that. The current world number one was in control of the championship until that point. She also missed a relatively short birdie putt on the 16th, so this is going to feel like one that really got away. But all credit to Ko, the only leading contender to break 70 on what was another very difficult afternoon.
We should, of course, discuss the British players. Charlie Hull appeared to fade slightly after day one.
Yes, a very disappointing weekend for Charlie Hull. A pair of 75s after a very encouraging start to the championship. She ended up in a share of 20th place. Really, the outstanding British performance came from Lottie Wode, who was the leading amateur. So she won the prestigious Smith Salver. The 20-year-old from Farnham finished in a share of 10th place, one under par. She is a really outstanding British prospect for the future.
And we should also mention that Suzanne Pettersen, she's going to name her European Solheim Cup side later today. Any surprises expected?
I don't think so. Britain's Georgia Hall is waiting to hear whether she's going to be included. That's an unfamiliar position for her, normally among the eight qualifiers. Charlie Hull, Leona Maguire are in, as is the German Olympic silver medalist Esther Henselite for her debut. Others looking for a wild card today, they include Anna Nordqvist and Emily Pedersen. They're going to bring plenty of experience, but it has to be said, a lack of recent form.
Ian Carter, our golf correspondent, thank you for your time this morning. Just a few other bits of sports news. Yesterday, there were wins for Chelsea and Liverpool in the Premier League, while Bournemouth and Newcastle drew. There were victories in the Scottish Premiership for Celtic, Aberdeen and Motherwell. Lando Norris won Formula One's Dutch Grand Prix for McLaren. The Brit finished ahead of home favourite Max Verstappen of Red Bull, while Charles Leclerc came third for Ferrari. In Rugby League, Wigan Warriors, they're back on level points with Hull KR at the top of the Super League table. That's after beating Hull FC, while Lee Leopards won away at London Broncos. And also in tennis, the US Open gets underway later today in New York, with Coco Gauff and Novak Djokovic defending champions. There are six Brits in action at Flushing Meadows, with coverage starting this afternoon on Five Sports Extra from 4 p.m.
Thank you, Sarah.
If you're looking for laughs,
this is where the magic happens.
BBC iPlayer's got you covered.
Good. Life is interesting at last.
With over 3,000 episodes of comedy favourites.
They make for great entertainers.
I need a shortlist.
Including The Office, Two Doors Down, The Thick of It, and many more.
Oh, what is that?
Whoa. Put my staple inside a jelly again.
Bring on the laughs.
What are you laughing at?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Quick look at the weather. Variable cloud and sunny spells for most of the day. A few light showers are still possible in the north. However, cloud and rain will start to move in from the northwest towards the evening. A bit more downbeat, that forecast, than Thomas Schaffernacker told us a bit earlier. I'm not sure who to believe.
Sunny Schaffernacker. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Lise Doucette. It is now 30 minutes past 7, and a summary of the news is coming now from Alan Smith.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an immediate end to hostilities between Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon. He says he's deeply concerned after the two sides mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. The United States says it's working to avoid a further escalation in hostilities, and Britain has urged all parties in the region to show restraint. The news agency Reuters says a British employee has been killed in a missile strike on a hotel in eastern Ukraine. Ryan Evans was a security advisor working alongside a reporting team in the city of Kramatorsk, near the front line. Two other members of Reuters' staff are in hospital. One has serious injuries. The encrypted messaging service Telegram has called the arrest of its owner in France absurd. The Russian-born billionaire Pavel Durov was detained at an airport near Paris. The platform has been accused of failing to cooperate with investigations into drug trafficking, fraud and child sex abuse images. Telegram says it abides by all EU laws. From today, people in England and Wales will be able to hand in zombie-style knives at police stations and, in some cases, claim money for them as part of an amnesty scheme. The measures come ahead of a ban on the weapons, which is due to come into force next month. The Conservatives have written to the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case demanding to know who authorised a Downing Street pass for the Labour donor Lord Ali. The Sunday Times revealed that the Labour peer had been issued with the pass for number 10, but Downing Street said it had now been handed back. The Conservatives say it's deeply concerning it was issued at all. And a new law has come into force in Australia, offering relief to millions of workers who feel that they have to take calls or read messages from their employers after they finish their day's work. The Right to Disconnect law allows workers to ignore after-hours communications if they choose to, without fear of being punished by their employers.
Thank you, Alan. It's now 7:32 a.m. And while we've been on air, there's been news Coming from the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, reports of loud explosions being heard in the capital. And there does seem to be a nationwide alert about Russian airstrikes. Let's join our Europe correspondent, Nick Beek, who's in Ukraine. Nick, what more do you know about the attacks this morning in Kyiv?
Good morning, Lisa. Yeah, this is looking like one of the larger early morning Russian attacks. And as you say, all of Ukraine has been under this air raid alert. That is still in place. And there are explosions, as far as we can see, in at least seven Ukrainian regions. A number of Russian missiles have been hitting various cities across the country. For example, there have been explosions in the city of Kharkiv in the northeast, Dnipro to the east. As you mentioned, the capital, Kyiv, very loud explosions, and also Odessa in the south. It's worth stressing that in all of these cases, it might be that the air defences are doing their work, bringing down the incoming Russian missiles and possibly drones. So hard to assess, but already there are reports that at least two people have been killed.
And Nick, I know you're now in the Sumy region of Ukraine that's bordering Russia, and you're there to keep an eye on the situation across the border in Kursk, where it's nearly, what, 3 weeks since the surprise raid by Ukrainian forces into Russian territory, and they're still there. And how are they faring?
They are still there, Lise. And what we saw over the weekend as Ukraine celebrated 33 years of independence, the recent Ukrainian gains actually on Russian soil shaped and coloured and actually energised the whole weekend of celebrations. There had been this warning that there might be Russian attacks to try and thwart these celebrations. But certainly what's happening in Kursk, the biggest invasion of Russia since the Second World War, has boosted morale among lots of Ukrainians. They were telling us this. But undoubtedly, this remains a really high-risk gamble for President Zelensky. And over the past few days for this programme, we've been talking to soldiers who've been telling us that the operation in the Kursk region is getting tougher, and at the same time, the Ukrainian operation there hasn't really eased the situation on the front line to the east in Ukraine itself. And of course, that for President Zelensky had been a major hope.
Well, this is a celebration of Ukrainian music. We're here in the heart of Kyiv on a rooftop. And all of the classics here, whether they're nostalgic oldies or new hits, are being performed with the defiant spirit of a nation currently at war. It's one of about 400 events taking place across the country in the face of warnings of an increased risk of Russian missiles and drones being launched because Ukraine is celebrating its Independence Day.
We're used to it, and it's awful that we live in this dangerous situation. They can kill us, but they cannot make us scared.
Yulia is a 19-year-old student. What are your feelings today on Ukraine's Independence Day? Because clearly it's been 2.5 years of a brutal war now.
I was watching the TV and I saw our president, Zelensky, and honestly I was crying.
Ukrainian forces have actually gone into Russia, into the Kursk region. What do you think of that? And has that given people a boost?
It was for us like an amazing event. It's like a miracle for us, but we are so happy with it.
As many as 10,000 elite Ukrainian troops are said to have burst across the border and seized in a matter of days more land than Russia has taken in Ukraine so far this year.
3 weeks into the incursion, and we're still in contact with one of the Ukrainian soldiers who went in. Let's call him Sergei. This is his latest message, and he writes, "At the beginning of the operation, we were on the rise. We had a minimum of losses. Now, because of the Russians' fire, we're losing a lot of guys. Moreover, the Russians here are fighting for their land, just as we are fighting for ours. Many of us do not understand the meaning of this operation. It's one thing to fight for Kharkiv or Zaporizhia. It's another matter for the Kursk region, which we don't need." So it seems that after the initial enthusiasm, for Sergei at least, there is some scepticism about where this goes next.
The gains of the Kursk incursion need to be tempered against continuing losses in the east of Ukraine itself, where Russia continues to make ground in an attritional battle. As Moscow's troops draw nearer, many families have been fleeing the city of Pokrovsk, including Ludmila, carrying her possessions.
It's loud here. Constant explosions for the past days. Ban, 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 ban. Everyone is in panic. People are running away.
It's difficult. It's difficult all the time.
We got through to 23-year-old Nazar Voitenkov, a volunteer with the 33rd Mechanized Brigade, defending Pokrovsk. Have you seen the Russians moving away from where you are? Has it become easier?
No, I don't feel. I think Russians have a resource of troops in Kursk region and also in Russia, because Russians use a lot of weapons to cover our towns with missiles and bombs, shells, and destroy our cities.
President Zelensky attended a solemn ceremony outside the Golden Domes of St. Sophia's Cathedral in Kyiv. But for his pre-recorded speech, he appeared near the border with Russia, hailing the recent seizure of Russian land.
Russia waged war on us. It violated not only sovereign borders, but also the limits of cruelty and common sense. It was endlessly seeking one thing, to destroy us. And what the enemy brought to our land has now returned to its own home.
This weekend's celebrations were undoubtedly invigorated by the recent success on Russian soil. But Ukraine's path to next year's Independence Day is no less clear and remains lined with danger and uncertainty.
Nick Beek reporting there. It is 39 minutes past seven. There's a real last bank holiday a year, a real kind of back to work kind of feeling in the air. No one will be feeling that more than Keir Starmer. So Keir Starmer, if he looks at the papers today, PM under pressure over number 10 pass for donor is the headline in the Telegraph. Questions about who signed off on a Downing Street pass for one of his biggest private donors, who's paid for a lot of his suits and even glasses. And that's why Daily Mail's headline is Starmer in passes for glasses, sleaze row. Elsewhere, they say there's a cabinet split as Labour MPs fear voter backlash over that winter fuel allowance cut, saying it's coming up on the doorstep in emails and letters. There's bad feelings about the decision, said one Labour MP. And of course, we know tomorrow that Sir Keir Starmer is going to say things are going to get worse before they get better. And a decade to rebuild Britain after Tories, said Starmer. Hard work ahead. This is in the Times. Labour leader to blame rubble and ruin left by predecessor.
And many of the papers also have on their front page the Middle East crisis. In the Mirror, it is the in red print. Middle East crisis escalates. Brink of war, it says. Fears of all-out war in the Middle East were last night growing after Israel launched huge airstrikes on Hezbollah in Lebanon. The paper says that military chief claims yesterday's blitz with 100 jets was a preemptive attack at missile sites where militants were plotting to hit Israel. Minutes later, the Financial Times describes it as stakes raised, Hezbollah and Israel clash. It has a dramatic photograph. It's also on the front page of the Daily Telegraph of Israel shooting down a Hezbollah drone over northern Israel. And The Guardian has a quotation from Netanyahu. The Telegraph has it as well. Airstrikes on Hezbollah, not the end of the story.
And if you need something to look forward to, then perhaps if you're an Oasis fan from the 1990s, definitely no maybes is the headline in The Sun, saying after 15 years looking back in anger, Noel and Liam Gallagher end feud in phone call and reform. Lots of speculation. They're about to announce a series of dates. The Daily Mail suggests that could be because Noel Gallagher's just had a very expensive divorce and may need a bit of extra cash. But they are back. Oasis I reunion. We'll talk to Miranda Sawyer and Steve Lamack about that possibility a little bit later in the programme.
And it's not just back to work. It is back to school. And The Guardian has a story saying the schools faced post-COVID peak of bad behaviour. paper says that teachers returning to work next month will confront a worrying behavior bubble as the younger children who were most severely affected by the COVID pandemic reach the teenage years, renowned for peak classroom disruption.
28 minutes to seven. Pavel Durov, the Russian-born billionaire who founded the messaging app Telegram, was arrested in France on Saturday and yesterday had his detention extended by French authorities. Durov is accused of failing to take action to curb the criminal use of his platform and was stopped after arriving in Paris from Baku on his private jet. A little earlier, I spoke to Zoe Kleiman, the BBC's technology editor, who said we're not still sure, it's not quite sure exactly on which charges he's been detained.
Well, reportedly it's to do with moderation on Telegram and failure to comply with authorities' demands for information. We don't know for sure because nothing else has been said since yesterday. There are reports that Pavel Durov might be in court today in France, at which point we might find out more. It is really interesting if that is the case, because it is pretty unprecedented for the owner of a messaging platform to be arrested because of what's happening on that platform itself.
Yeah, and what do we know about this chap Durov?
Pavel Durov is an interesting character. He was born in Russia, but he left Russia in 2014. He set up a massive social network in Russia called VKontakte and then refused to shut down opposition communities on it and hand over data to the Russian authorities. He left Russia at that point. He now lives in Dubai. He founded Telegram, which is based in Dubai. We know that he's a multi-billionaire. We don't actually know whether he still has Russian citizenship or not, but the Russian embassy says that it is trying to get in touch with him. So he has a history of not complying, I suppose, with requests for help. But Telegram itself does say that it is operating within the Digital Services Act, which is the act which governs big online platforms in Europe.
What is special about Telegram? Because, you know, for example, WhatsApp has end-to-end encryption. But I know from experience, journalists, politicians, a lot of them use Telegram. What's its particular appeal?
So the big difference with Telegram is the size of the groups that you can be in. In WhatsApp, a group is limited to just over 1,000 people. On Telegram, you can have groups of up to 200,000, Simon. And they're basically used like broadcast channels. They're for sharing information with an enormous number of people. Now, of course, alongside that, they can also be used for sharing disinformation. Telegram is considered to be a secure messaging platform. It does offer encryption, which means the messages can only be read by the device which sends them and the device that receives them. And that is in line with the others. But you have to activate it. It's not on by default. And that is a little loophole that I think not everybody knows. The issue with it, of course, is the data that's being shared. And there are suggestions that it's used to share disinformation. It's used a lot by both Russia and Ukraine to discuss the conflict there. It's also faced scrutiny recently for being used in organising the riots that we had here in England.
I mean, the fact that he's been arrested in France, I think a spokesperson for him said that he travels frequently in Europe. And they also say, by the way, Telegram abides by EU laws, including the Digital Service Act. Its moderation is within industry standards and constantly improving. What message are the French authorities sending?
I think this depends, doesn't it, on whether this is a Europe-wide warrant or a French warrant. We're going to have to wait and see just how international this is. But it is unprecedented. And I think it really is a big comment on this whole online safety versus freedom of speech debate that's raging online, fueled not just a little bit by Elon Musk, the owner of X.
I was wondering whether he'd responded to this yet. I the kind of thing that he would take a great interest in, I'm sure.
You might imagine that he's waded in on this on X. He has been writing a lot of posts about it. There is a hashtag Free Pavel, which was trending a few hours ago. So I think we are going to see ripples for this. I think it's going to spark a lot of debate and a lot of anger for those who think social messaging platforms shouldn't be tightly moderated in the way that they are. Musk himself has said moderation is a propaganda word for censorship, which, of course, are very strong words. But ultimately, what law enforcement would say is that the use of these apps for criminal activity, including things like drug trafficking and child sexual abuse, cannot be tolerated.
Zoe, thank you.
Time now for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Akhand Haridas, Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian.
Good morning.
After a weekend of tempestuous weather, I hope you get to enjoy this late summer bank holiday. Coincidentally, today is also a holy day, one of the holiest festivals in the Hindu calendar. Here and around the world, millions of Hindus are celebrating Janmashtami, commemorating the appearance of Krishna some 5,000 years ago. Krishna is considered an immanent manifestation of the divine. He is both the source of creation and also intimately related to the lives of all beings. This fulfills the paradox of the Upanishad saying, the Supreme is far away, but is very near as well. He is within everything, yet he is outside of everything. He is unborn and eternal, yet he can appear amongst us. The scriptural narrative of Krishna is understood by many Hindus as an account of divine intercedence in human history, but also one containing many messages illuminating and guiding human life. For example, before Krishna's appearance, the despotic king Kamsa feared a prophecy that Krishna's mother Devaki would bear a powerful son who would challenge his dubious claim to the throne. Kamsa seized Devaki, ready to murder her. Devaki's husband, Vasudev, pleaded for his wife, and his negotiations with Kamsa exemplify how one should use one's intelligence to try to subdue the base instincts arising in our mind. Vasudev reminded Kamsa of his status and duty as a king and a relative. He chided, "Your cousin deserves your protection, not your brutality. Why let your fears drive you into bad decisions and rash action?" But often, rational thinking isn't enough to overcome our wayward desires and emotions. And Kamsa wasn't moved. Vasudev's only option was to delay Kamsa's intentions by promising, "You have nothing to fear from Devaki. If we do have sons, I will deliver all of them into your hands." With this, Kamsa relented. He would trust Vasudev's commitment for now. This was no epiphany or change of heart, but an accommodation and cooling off. Sometimes that's the best that's on offer. And in this incident, it was sufficient to alter the later outcome. One Vaishnav scholar called Janmashtami the mother of devotion, an occasion to appreciate what matters to us, and if needed, to reorientate ourselves towards our chosen path. Holidays and religious festivals can be a mini break from the hard reality of the world. Sometimes just a little distance from our fears and worries can give us new perspective, one in which our intelligence might shine through and reveal the best steps forward.
And that was Thought for the Day with Akhandadi Das, Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian.
It's 10 to 8. People who own zombie knives, which are these rather gruesome-looking long blades with serrated edges and points and spikes on them, are being urged to hand them in and claim compensation in some cases ahead of a ban coming into force from the 24th of September. People are asked to get in touch with their local police station for advice on how to package up the weapons and bring them in safely. Alternatively, you can surrender bins are available for those who wish to remain anonymous. The current and previous government want to halve knife crime in a decade. So will this help that? Tyler Clancy is a youth worker in and around Islington in London. His best friend was stabbed to death 4 years ago. And we can also speak to DCI Ian Hughes from Essex Police, the Serious Violence Unit, speaking on tackling knife crime and their part in the government's amnesty scheme. Good morning to you both. If I could start with you, Tyler. You work in and around Islington. How prevalent are these kind of weapons? In what circumstances do you see them?
We are seeing them more and more every single day. Young people are absolutely petrified to be out on the streets. We find that usually the young people that are carrying these knives are more so carrying them for their own safety, and they have absolutely no intention of using them. Though that does still, you know, there is still a huge, huge danger there, but that is our job to essentially remind them of that danger and that although they may feel unsafe, the only answer is not just to carry a knife.
Yeah, because most, I think, knife crime happens with something you get from the kitchen or what have you, but these are seen as sending a certain message, knives like this.
I can certainly see why, and I believe, you know, it's more of a thing that they want to scare people away, rather than just kind of it's more of a deterrent, I believe, and that's the message that I find a lot of the young people kind of want to use with these. They want to be seen as, you know, the baddest ones. You don't go near them, and you don't hurt them. That obviously they don't understand the full intention of those knives and the true message that it shows. But we try our best in letting these young people know what sort of message they are sending, not only to these other people in deterring them away, but also to the wider audience as well that may be seeing them.
Yeah. Stay with me. I want to talk to DCI Ian Hughes. DCI Hughes, what's special about these knives? As I say, I can just pick up something from a kitchen drawer. What is the added benefit of banning these particular type of knives?
Good morning, Simon. And first of all, I'd just like to pass on my condolences to Tyler. So, you know, losing one person is horrendous, and I just want to pass on my condolences there. You know, Tyler spoke a lot of sense, and it's absolutely what we see in Essex, and it's part of that national picture. The myth of carrying knives and what that represents when people carry knives in their almost a status, I suppose, and it's around intimidation. And these zombie-style knives, machetes, they're big, they're scary, and they are, or have been, you know, quite easy to get hold of over the years. And that is what we really want to focus on. Tyler really summarised it really well. We really want to dispel that myth that people need to carry knives to protect themselves, because you are going to create a higher risk of them being used against you.
It sort of creates a sort of arms race. Do you think this, I mean, we've had amnesties on knives before. What are the problems with them, and under what circumstances do they work? Because I just wonder if you're the kind of person who's carrying one of these very gruesome, kind of very violent looking weapons, are you going to pop into your local police station, just hand it over and say, here you go?
So the Home Office have put in a financial incentive. So we hope that will go some way to provide people with the incentive to come in, but also the confidence that for this period of time from the 26th of August today through to the 23rd of September, that these weapons can be brought to a local police station. There's 8 police stations throughout Essex, and the details of that are available on the government website. And they can deposit them without any fear of prosecution.
Are they going to trust that? I mean, are they going to think, by handing this in, I am self-identifying as somebody the police might want to be interested? That's what some people will think.
And my reassurance that's not the purpose of this. We want to encourage people to come into the police station, and we recognise that actually that might be quite tricky for people. So there is no form of prosecution being suggested, because actually at this moment in time, that's the amnesty is there to recover.
But what happens if you find out that one of the weapons that has been handed in was in fact used in a crime? What's the situation there? And would you take, for example, fingerprints?
None of the items that are being recovered are being forensically recovered. They are being received into the front offices and booked into our property systems. And that is the process. It's an amnesty. It's about handing in. It's no different to somebody coming to one of our knife bins, as you've suggested, and depositing them in there. Yes, there is a form that needs to be downloaded and completed, but that is to facilitate the compensation. If people don't want compensation, there's also an ability there to fill out a section of the form, which is far simpler. But also, if the weapons they bring in don't fit the remit of the zombie-style knives or machetes, they can still deposit them and hand them in, and that's the main objective, taking weapons off our streets and reducing the risks in our communities.
Surely one of the best ways of doing this is just preventing their sale in the UK, and I just wonder whether you're hoping that this amnesty will also be, any retailers who've got hanging on to them might bring them in as well.
Absolutely. The part of the legislation is that people can't sell them anymore. So it covers both bases. It's possession, and that's in private and in public. It's always been an offence to have these in a public setting. But this now extends to private settings. So if you've got them even ornamentally on the wall, because they're quite dramatic, and you might have one up on a wall, that will be that will constitute an offence come the 24th of September. So when it comes to retailers, we've got our kind of high street stores, which we don't have huge amounts that sell these types of knives, but our business crime team in Essex have been engaging with these retailers that we do have with a view of making sure that we can facilitate the surrendering of those weapons that they may sell safely in bulk.
Yeah.
But also we're looking at how we can work with our online retailers, and we work with the Border Force Agency around importation as well. But that's a national picture that the NCA will, National Crime Agency will be leading on.
I just want to briefly go back to Tyler. Do you think this will work? You work with these, with young people. Are they going to think this is an amnesty, is a great opportunity for me to go down to my local police station?
I absolutely think it's a great step, though it's on a staircase that isn't built yet. I think that the correct infrastructure in order for this to successfully work needs to be put in place. And that infrastructure that I'm talking about is that youth workers and youth provisions are there to do the work to get them to these spaces where they're able to feel comfortable enough to use these initiatives. I think the reason that that we ain't going to be able to work and we haven't got the youth workers and the youth provisions is because youth workers aren't being treated as professionals and essential, combined together.
I hear you, Tyler. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there because we're just coming up to the top of the hour. But Tyler Clancy and before that, DCI Ian Hughes from Essex Police. Thank you both.
And here's Thomas Schaffernacker with the weather.
Lise, thank you very much. We've got a fine day on the way. At the moment, a little overcast in some areas and also quite damp, particularly in the northwest of England. But the skies are starting to clear, for example, around Liverpool and also Manchester. Elsewhere across the country, further east and south, it's already beautiful with sunny skies. And that's how the afternoon is looking. The rest of the morning and the afternoon, sunny spells developing nationwide or all across all of our nations. Temperatures today up to 23 in London and the southeast, but obviously fresher the further north we go, around 18 on the Irish Sea coast, 18 in Northern Ireland, and about that in Northern Scotland. And then this evening and overnight, rain sweeping in off the Atlantic. It'll reach northwestern and western areas of the UK. And then tomorrow, a little bit of a mixed bag with some rain in the west, but very warm and sunny in the southeast.
Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. Later this week on BBC Radio 4.
I'm Kavita Puri, and in 3 Million, I explore the story of the Bengal famine in British India 80 years ago.
What are you going to eat? What will you feed your children with?
Now I'm travelling to Bengal to capture the powerful testimonies of those who remember it before it's too late.
I was only 9 years old then.
People had no food to eat. No clothes to wear.
We went through so much pain, so much hardship.
A new episode of 3 Million on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this Thursday morning at 9:30.
And at 8:10, we return to the Middle East and assess the risks of an all-out regional war after yesterday's dramatic escalation on the Israel-Lebanon front.
You're listening today on BBC Radio 4 with Lise Doucette and Simon Jack. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 26th of August. The headlines this morning. There have been international calls for restraint after Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. Russia has launched a major drone and missile attack on Ukraine, with explosions reported in several cities. A search is beginning near the Irish border for the remains of a British soldier abducted and murdered by the IRA nearly 50 years ago. And the return of Oasis. Is it definitely happening or just maybe? We'll be discussing the chance of a reunion tour later this hour. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said he's deeply concerned after Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. The US says it's working to avoid a further escalation in hostilities, and Britain has urged all parties in the region to show restraint. Yesterday, Israel carried out airstrikes on dozens of sites in southern Lebanon in what it said was a preemptive attack. Hezbollah launched hundreds of rockets and drones towards northern Israel. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell has sent this report from Jerusalem.
While Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon appear to have paused hostilities, tensions remain dangerously high, triggering international calls for restraint. There are reports of diplomatic efforts through intermediaries to try to contain the situation. In a televised speech, the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah told Lebanon it could take a breath after his group completed its revenge attack for a top commander killed in an Israeli airstrike last month. And US and Israeli officials gave further details of how intelligence had detected signs that Hezbollah was preparing to launch a major missile and drone attack, leading Israeli warplanes to take preemptive action before dawn yesterday. Mediators say that the dramatic attacks have not derailed talks on a Gaza ceasefire, which have been taking place in Cairo, though so far there's been no sign of a breakthrough.
Russia has launched major drone attacks on several Ukrainian cities this morning. The mayor of Kyiv said water and power supplies had been disrupted. Earlier, the news agency Reuters confirmed that a British man who was working as a safety advisor in eastern Ukraine was killed in a missile strike on a hotel. Nick Beek reports from Ukraine.
Reuters announced that they were devastated at Ryan Evans's death. They said the former British soldier had helped many of their journalists cover events around the world and that he would be tremendously missed. Mr. Evans was killed and two other colleagues injured after a missile hit their hotel in the city of Kramatorsk, which is under Ukrainian control, but close to the front line. President Zelensky sent his condolences, concluding, "This is the daily Russian terror that continues." Moscow has not commented on the strike. This morning, all of Ukraine has been under air raid alert, with more Russian missiles reported to have been fired at a number of regions. There have been explosions in the city of Kharkiv in the northeast, Dnipro in the east, and Melnitsky in the west. In the capital Kyiv, air defences could be heard attempting to intercept incoming fire.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is to visit the city of Solingen this morning to commemorate the victims of Friday's knife attack in which three people died and eight were injured. A suspect has been arrested and identified as Issa Al-H, a 26-year-old Syrian man who came to Germany as an asylum seeker. He's accused of being a member of Islamic State. Damian McGuinness reports from Berlin.
The deadly stabbing in Solingen on Friday evening has sparked a debate about migration in Germany. Conservative opposition politicians are calling for radical measures, including controls on all German borders, and wants Germany to stop taking in refugees from Syria and Afghanistan. This morning, Chancellor Scholz will commemorate the victims of the attack in Solingen. His left-wing party is calling for tighter controls on knives and says that Germany will continue taking in those fleeing persecution, but asylum seekers who commit crimes must be deported. The leader of the far-right AfD, meanwhile, wants a complete ban on all migration.
An amnesty and compensation scheme for people in England and Wales who possess zombie-style knives and machetes starts today, ahead of the weapons being banned next month. New legislation will make it an imprisonable offence to own, make, transport or sell a wide range of what are called statement knives favoured by criminal gangs. More details from our home editor, Mark Easton.
Zombie knives, Rambo knives, serrated long-bladed machetes, weapons designed to intimidate and terrorise. The government tried a ban in 2016, but a loophole meant some items bypassed the rule. Ahead of the legislation coming into force on the 24th of September, people who currently legally possess such knives can hand them into police stations without fear of prosecution, and in some cases claim compensation. Three zombie-style knives would be worth at least £30 under the scheme. There are exemptions for people who have good reason to own the items, for example, a specialist machete used in forestry or an antique samurai sword, but people who do own long-bladed weapons are advised to check with their local police on whether they fall foul of the law.
A 32-year-old woman is in a life-threatening condition in hospital after being stabbed at the Notting Hill Carnival. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the first day of the event yesterday. Greg McKenzie reports.
In a statement, the Met Police said it was aware of three stabbings at the West London Carnival yesterday. In the most serious case, a 32-year-old woman was injured and is in a life-threatening condition in hospital. Two men aged 24 and 29 also received knife wounds. Around 90 people were arrested for a range of alleged crimes, including assault on an emergency worker and robbery. 7,000 police officers are patrolling this year's two-day event, which celebrates Caribbean heritage and culture.
More than 100 people have been evacuated from a building in East London, partly used as a block of flats, after a fire broke out in the early hours. More than 200 firefighters are at the scene in Dagenham. Two people have been taken to hospital. This resident says his six-year-old daughter was in the building with her friend when the fire broke out.
They are calm now, but they were terrified initially. I got a call around 3 o'clock from inmates that there's a fire in their building, and my daughter was there for a sleepover, and I had to kind of quickly drive to nearby and reach them. So they managed to get out of the building on time.
A search is to begin near the Irish border later today for the remains of a British soldier murdered by the IRA in 1977. Captain Robert Nerick is one of the so-called disappeared, a group of victims whose bodies were hidden after they were shot. Julian O'Neill reports from Belfast.
Robert Narak was operating undercover when he was abducted outside a pub in South Armagh. He was taken across the border and shot by the IRA, his body buried at a secret location. 47 years later, a dig for his remains is due to take place on farmland in County Louth, a few miles from Dundalk. What's finally made this search possible is credible information being passed to the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains, the organisation in charge of finding where Republicans hid the bodies of people known as the disappeared during the Troubles.
Millions of workers in Australia have been given the right to disconnect to help them keep a work-life balance. New legislation means they can now legally ignore unreasonable out-of-hours calls, emails and texts from their bosses. Fish and chips is a British summer holiday favourite, but new figures show the cost of a fish supper has risen more than other popular takeaway foods. The average price for a portion of fish and chips has soared by more than 50% in the last 5 years, as Tommy Lum reports.
Fish and chips is a British family favourite, equally enjoyed around the table or on an overcast beach. But new figures suggest the national delicacy has seen the steepest price increase of the UK's most popular takeaways. A portion of fish and chips rose 52% to an average of nearly £10 in the 5 years to July, according to estimates from the Office for National Statistics. That was more than a kebab, which went up 44%, and pizza at 30%. Chip shop owners say they've been particularly badly hit by energy bill rises as their fryers use a lot of electricity, as well as the impact of sanctions on Russian seafood due to the invasion of Ukraine.
There's growing speculation that an Oasis reunion could finally be about to happen. Both Noel and Liam Gallagher have teased a possible announcement, as Chris Berrow reports.
Fans have been hoping for years that the warring Gallagher brothers might end their 15-year feud and take to the stage together again. The Sunday Times reported yesterday that the brothers were set to perform a series of gigs next year. There's speculation this could include a headline slot at Glastonbury. To add to the expectation, Liam Gallagher dedicated the Oasis track Half the World Away to his brother during his set at Reading Festival last night. And on Instagram, both brothers have posted a clip of a sign in the style of the Oasis logo. Tomorrow's date is written in the middle, which then changes to 8 a.m, suggesting an announcement could be imminent.
That was Chris Berrow.
Thank you, Alan Smith. It's 10 minutes past eight. Ever since the Gaza war erupted more than 10 months ago, there has been tension and exchanges of fire along the border between Israel and Lebanon. But yesterday marked the most significant escalation yet. The Lebanese group Hezbollah fired a barrage of missiles and drones towards Israel, and Israeli warplanes bombed dozens of targets in southern Lebanon. As always, there's a dispute over the details. Israel says its attacks were preemptive strikes. Hezbollah denies that and says it acted in retaliation for Israel's killing of its senior commander, Fuad Shukr, in Beirut last month. Both sides are saying their operations are over for now. How does it look this morning? Let's cross to Tyre in southern Lebanon to speak to our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin. Orla, all of the details are not in, but what is known so far about what Hezbollah was targeting in Israel and whether they hit their mark?
Well, they're claiming, Lise, that the attack was a complete success, that they intended to fire 320 Katyusha rockets, and that's exactly what they did. In a very lengthy and detailed speech by the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah last night, he went through the list of targets, and he said one of the main ones had been an intelligence base in central Israel, which was home to Mossad. He also mentioned an air base from which drones were launched. Now, the Israeli Defense Force has been stressing since yesterday that no military bases or military locations were hit. So we find ourselves between the two competing sides with competing denials and competing claims. I think what's very interesting about yesterday is what Hezbollah did not do. They chose a list of targets that were military bases and military barracks in the north of Israel. They did not try to hit any critical infrastructure. They did not hit civilian targets. They did not target a major city. And indeed, they didn't kill any civilians. And neither did Israel. With the strikes that Israel carried out in the early hours of the morning at about 4:30, which it says were preemptive to prevent a bigger Hezbollah assault, Israel also targeted military positions of the armed group, saying it destroyed many rocket launchers. So each side was extremely careful about what they did, and it was a very calibrated response.
And Hassan Nasrallah made it clear in his remarks that that was in part because they don't want to jeopardize the ceasefire talks taking place now, taking place in Cairo.
That's right, Lise. He went into a great deal of detail in his speech, sort of deconstructing the whole attack, explaining why Hezbollah had waited until now. Listeners will remember that at the end of July, the Israelis carried out an assassination in Beirut in the Hezbollah stronghold of Dahiya, where they killed a very senior commander, a top military commander called Fuad Shukr. Now, since then, the region has been on tenterhooks waiting for a Hezbollah response that was promised and that was inevitably going to come. It took longer than some people expected. Now, Hassan Nasrallah said last night that there were two main reasons for this. One was that the Americans were on high alert, and that's something that Hezbollah had to take into account. But he said the other was that it wanted to give time for progress on a ceasefire. But he basically indicated in the end it had given up on that because the talks could go on and on, nothing might be achieved. And also he claimed, as indeed critics have claimed in Israel, that the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is stalling. Mm. So the point was made that this could have happened earlier, but that it was a very deliberate decision to wait. And there was a briefing separately yesterday by a Hezbollah official saying that the response, Hezbollah's response to the assassination had been delayed by political considerations, and chief among those was the attempt to get a ceasefire. Mm. And I think when we look at the scope of what Hezbollah did yesterday, they are still trying to leave the door open for ceasefire talks to continue, for progress to be made. Yes. Will that happen? There's certainly nothing to indicate it at the moment.
Orla Geerin, do take care, but thank you for joining us from southern Lebanon. Let's go to Sir John Soares now, former chief of MI6 now. Hello, Sir John. I know you follow very closely every twist and turn in this Middle East crisis. How do you assess the temperature now?
Well, good morning, Lise. I think Orla Geerin is right in assessing that both sides have been carefully calibrating their attacks over the last 24 hours. it seems that Hezbollah were targeting the Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv. It also seems that they fell well short of making any impact there. We would know had there been a successful strike. And it's striking how Hassan Nasrallah is trying to draw a line under the events of the last 24 hours. I think the Israelis have assessed that neither Iran nor Hezbollah want to trigger a wider conflict. The Israelis don't want to either, because the Americans are very strongly opposed. They'd be very angry if it was Israel who triggered the region into a wider conflict. But the Israelis are pushing forward. They're pushing the envelope, as they did with the killing of Fuad Shukr, of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. So the Israelis, I think, are ahead on point at this stage. They have achieved some of their own security goals in Lebanon with the killing of Shukr, and they've successfully preempted much of yesterday's strike by their attacks on rocket launchers.
So you assess that Israel is, in your words, ahead on points, but this is a fast-moving and indeed a very dangerous game. We've heard from Iran's foreign minister this morning speaking to his Italian counterpart, And his phrase is our response, because Iran also wants to retaliate, it says, definite, calculated and accurate. So that threat has not gone away.
That's true. I mean, I suspect one other reason for the delay in the response to the Shukra killing was...
And the killing of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran.
But what we saw yesterday was probably the response to the Shukra killing. But I think the Iranians would have been keen to push Hezbollah out in front. The Haniyeh killing in Tehran was an embarrassment for the Iranians, but it didn't... no Iranian commanders or leaders were killed. And if they can use Hezbollah as their vehicle for retaliation, well, that avoids the risk of a wider conflict. And I also think the Iranians are quite keen to see an end to the, at least a ceasefire in the conflict in Gaza. The Qatari Prime Minister, one of the key mediators, along with the Americans and the Egyptians, is going to Tehran today, I understand, and to try to keep the Iranians on track for an agreement on Gaza. The Iranians aren't signatories to it, they're not party to it, but they will have some influence over Hamas on it. So I think that process is on course as well.
We hear today, and it happens every time there is an escalation, that the United States is doing everything it can to try to reduce the risk of an all-out war. How do you assess the weight of the Americans at this moment? There's always so much talk about that they are, that their power is draining away from them.
Well, I think when 6 weeks ago, when it looked very likely that Donald Trump was going to win a second term in the White House, I think Netanyahu felt able to play the Americans a bit. Now the outlook in the American elections is much less certain. Netanyahu's visit to Washington at the end of July was very low key. He wasn't at all provocative, as perhaps he might have been had Biden not stood down, had the momentum not been returning to the Democratic Party. So I think the Israelis and Netanyahu himself need to be quite cautious about how they play the Americans at this stage, because none of us know what the outcome of the November election is going to be, or who's going to be in the White House after next January. So there's a bit of uncertainty being added in there. But the other calculation, which we've not mentioned for Netanyahu, is his own political position at home. It's striking that the Israeli military chiefs seem content with the framework that's been hammered out in the negotiations with Hamas, including for the broad withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. But that would cause political problems for Netanyahu within his coalition. So it's partly security concerns here, it's partly American influence, but also Netanyahu's own political calculations about how to keep his coalition together during these times. And of course, it's a pretty ugly coalition that he's leading, including some very far-right political leaders in the Israeli spectrum.
I know security chiefs don't like to make predictions. Very briefly, what is the chances that these talks are going to succeed, a ceasefire and bringing hostages home?
Well, it, in some ways, getting the Hezbollah strike out of the way removes one uncertainty in these negotiations. I don't think we're going to see a deal in the next few hours or a couple of days. Hamas continue to chisel away to try to get the maximum number of prisoners released for each hostage that they are holding. But I think the key decision is in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, with Netanyahu on one side and his security chiefs on the other. Netanyahu has to be brought around. And you talk about American pressure. I'm not sure the Americans have got a great deal of influence, direct influence, but Netanyahu will probably want to try to hold out for some of his security conditions, which the Israelis say, Israeli military say, are not absolutely essential.
We'll have to leave it there, John Soares, but thank you for joining us.
It's 20 past eight. This is the last bank holiday of the summer. And that means that our children's summer book club is coming to an end. That back to school feeling is approaching. So we thought today we would look at some of those transitions. Our panellists have one last chance to recommend books that mark endings or new beginnings, new school beginnings for some children. We are two giants of children's fiction, Frank Cottrell Boyce and Cressida Cowell, have joined us again. And first of all, thank you for all your submissions so far and all your ideas. I know you've got a couple of ideas each. Can I start with you, Cressida? What are you recommending to look at things like transitions, new beginnings for young readers?
Good morning.
Good morning.
The first picture book I'm recommending is called Lila Greer, Teacher of the Year. And it's for preschoolers anxious about starting school. It's part of a wonderful series by Andrea Beattie and illustrated stunningly by David Roberts. And it's about a kid who's nervous about starting school, but there's a real lump in the throat moment when the little kid turns into the teacher at the end. Oh. And any parent reading it with their kid it's a very moving moment. There's also so many wonderful books for preschoolers like Lauren Child's I Am Absolutely Too Small for School, Charlie and Lola, Starting School, Janet Olberg. But for the middle grade, I did more of a transition one, a year seven. Mm. This is a lovely book called Quiet Storm by Kimberly Whittam. And it's got an unexpected hero, because rather shy hero settling in with year seven. It's a lovely book for kids who love Jacqueline Wilson or that kind of fiction. And for older readers, teen and YA, I went for Heartstopper by Alice Oseman, which is more about first love. And I love these books because they're for teens. They're in a graphic novel. They're a graphic novel, really, but they're sort of in a normal novel format. And it's fantastic for kids or young teens who maybe aren't into reading. You know, it's a very visual, great books.
Thank you for those. I'll remind people of those at the end. But Frank, your turn. She hasn't nicked any of your ideas, I hope.
No, she hasn't. I going back to school can feel a bit bleak. I mean, it feels a bit early to be thinking about it even. But I have chosen The Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Gwynn, which is about the most exciting return to school you could possibly have. It's about a boy from the middle of nowhere who goes to wizard school. And I know
that idea will never catch on with kids.
I know that other wizards are available. Other boy wizards are available.
Yeah.
But I had to recommend this because this means so much to me, because this book made me into a SWAT, because this is a book about magic and knowledge, and it makes knowledge really glamorous and wonderful. And it changed my DNA, so I have to share that one.
Okay, and anything else? That is for what year? Well, what ages would you say?
That's definitely middle grade.
Middle grade.
For a much more recent book, I've chosen The Final Year by Matt Goodfellow, which is the story of Nate, who has had a best friend since nursery, and they're about to go to big school, but they're going to be put in different classes. It's such a tiny change, but it's sort of changed
the world, can't it, those little things?
Yeah, exactly. And what's fresh about this book, it's quite gritty, but one of the reasons I've chosen it is that school, it's a really positive image of school. And I find that, like, traditionally, these kind of stories have sort of hated school. But the children that I meet now have a much more positive attitude to school. School is a place of nurture. Yeah. It's a place where a lot of kids are fed. They're at school longer. So that's one of the reasons I've chosen this. The other reason is it's very fresh. It's in verse, which is very bright and breezy, and it's sort of very easy to read, and reminded me very much of a masterpiece by Mallory Blackman, which is Cloud Busting, which is also in verse. Yeah. And this is completely uncontroversial choice, but I have to say it. For the picture book, I have chosen a book you probably heard of called The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which is probably the most widely read book in the world, but the ultimate book about transition and transformation and the excitement of the new. And it's one of the reasons I've chosen it is that I've recently read, and this may be incorrect, but I'm going to share it anyway, that the first draft was about a worm.
Okay, we'll fact check that, shall we?
Yeah, do fact check it. But the editor said you might have a better ending if it's a butterfly. So
that's
worth remembering. Your first draft may not be all it's meant to be. Or we can learn from each other.
And Cressida, there's something about that transition. Is that I remember what I'm thinking of is that in Narnia, when all those books came and they all had to go back to school, the Lucy Pevensies and all of them, and then suddenly, boom, you're back in a different environment. It's quite a big thing.
Yes, it's a huge thing. Yes, that autumn term feeling. We all actually still feel it, don't we? As the weather changes, we still have that feeling we're about to start school again. Yeah. And yes, it's really, books can really help kids with that transition. Reading a book with your kid when you're safe, you know, when you're a little preschooler, don't underestimate sitting with your parents, but close to your parent or close to your carer, whatever. That feeling of safety and going through the transition first with them is a really powerful thing to do.
Okay.
And it also, if you're reading to your kids before they start actually having to learn to read at school,
right? Doesn't seem so daunting. Yeah.
Important.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Listen, thank you both so much for all your contributions. And just a reminder that all the suggestions we've had are online on the Today website. And if you have a favourite book on beginnings, endings, you can email us on today@bbc.co.uk as usual, or send us a voice note to our WhatsApp 0330 123 4346. Frank and Cressida, thank you.
I loved going back to school. I'm sure you did too, Simon.
I always wanted to make sure that this exercise book would have the neatest writing of any. By the end, it was a complete scrawl.
You're still trying. It's 27 minutes past eight, and now here's Sarah Orchard with the sport.
Thank you so much. Yes, I've got two back at school next week, so I've been making notes. Right then, the sports news. Later today, all eyes turn to New York for the US Open tennis, with Coco Gauff and Novak Djokovic defending singles champions. There'll be six Brits in action, but much of the build-up to the tournament has been dominated by world number one Jannik Sinner, who was cleared of any wrongdoing after twice testing positive for a banned substance in March. Earlier, I spoke with BBC tennis correspondent Russell Fuller about how the players have been reacting to the Sinner judgment.
Some certainly feel that the world number one has had preferential treatment in winning an appeal against the mandatory provisional suspension and then seeing his case resolved in less than 5 months. Now, Jannik Sinner has had to abide by the same rules as everyone else, but clearly he's got deep pockets and he can throw money at it and access to the very best legal team. And so it was interesting to hear Novak Djokovic asking for everyone to have the same type of treatment, whatever their ranking. He didn't go into details, but I think maybe what he was suggesting was some kind of legal aid fund whereby you get access to a lawyer to fight a case, whatever your ranking.
Yeah, something tells us we're going to be discussing this throughout the tournament. Just out of curiosity, how much focus is there on Emma Raducanu coming into this year's US Open, you know, 3 years now after that Grand Slam triumph in New York?
For the world number 72, there's plenty. Her picture is one of those you see as you walk around the grounds, as you'd expect, because she was a teenage champion as a qualifier here only 3 years ago. It will be only her second US Open match since, against Sofia Kenin on Tuesday. She played well at Wimbledon to reach the fourth round, did not play the Olympics, but didn't take the opportunity to play a series of events in North America. She played only once in 6 weeks. And as she told me the other day, she likes to do things differently. And at times this season has prioritized training over matches, having had last season cut short by those three operations on her hands and feet.
Yeah, Emma Raducanu, always a fascinating watch. Jack Draper, a lot of headlines after the Cincinnati Open. How is he?
Yes, well, he has had a difficult few days, having been awarded a half-volley net cord winner on match point in his second-round match against Felix Auger-Aliassime in Cincinnati a couple of weeks ago, when most people, admittedly after studying the slow-motion replay, thought he'd actually hit the ball into the ground and may even have touched it twice. But there was no video review available. The umpire's decision stood. He won the match. And he's had a lot of criticism on social media. He's had his integrity questioned on occasions by a few players. He says he understands why people have been critical and was actually arguing yesterday that he can benefit from the experience. But it's clearly bruised him to have his integrity as an athlete questioned in this way.
That was Russell Fuller, our tennis correspondent, speaking to me earlier. And coverage of the US Open from Flushing Meadows starts this afternoon on Five Sports Extra from 4 p.m. Cycling now, and it's a rest day in the Vuelta España after Britain's Adam Yates claimed victory on stage 9 yesterday. The UAE Team Emirates rider broke away in the Sierra Nevada mountains and managed to cross the line 1 minute 39 seconds ahead of his nearest rival. And do head to the BBC Sport website today for all the transfer window reports and gossip. The Telegraph are reporting today that Chelsea are considering a move for Manchester United winger Jadon Sancho in a deal that could include England forward Raheem Sterling in a swap deal.
Sarah, thank you. I look at the weather, and if I look out the window, it is sunny in central London, but it is variable cloud and sunny spells for most of the day. A few light showers are still possible in the north. Cloud and rain will start to move in for the northwest towards the evening.
It is, you are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Lise Doucette and Simon Jack. And at 29 minutes to 9, Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
Russia has launched a major drone and missile attack across Ukraine this morning. Explosions have been heard in many cities, from Lutsk in the west to Dnipro in the east. At least 3 people have been killed. Water and power supplies have been disrupted in several areas, including the capital, Kyiv. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he's deeply concerned after Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon mounted their biggest round of cross-border strikes since the war in Gaza began. The US says it's working to avoid further escalation in hostilities. An amnesty and compensation scheme for people in England and Wales who own so-called statement knives and machetes starts today. A ban on the weapons comes into force in a month's time. More than 100 people have been evacuated from a building in East London after a fire broke out in the early hours. More than 200 firefighters are at the scene in Dagenham. 2 people have been taken to hospital. And a search is to begin near the Irish border later today for the remains of a British soldier, Captain Robert Nairac, who was murdered by the IRA in 1977. The dig will take place on farmland in County Louth, a few miles from Dundalk.
Thank you, Alan. Reports have been coming in this morning of a series of heavy Russian airstrikes across Ukraine. Water and power are said to be affected in the capital, Kyiv. And residents, as always, are running into the shelters. They've been so used to doing it, but you never really get used to it, for the last 2.5 years, and to the network of underground train centres, bunkers and basement underground car parks. It's not yet clear the extent of the damage of this latest attack. News agencies are reporting a small number of deaths. And there's also reports from Russia that they're coming under Ukrainian drone attack, although on a much smaller scale. We're joined now by President Zelensky's economic advisor, Alexander Vernyansky. Thank you for joining us, especially on a morning like this. Are you getting many details about how these airstrikes are affecting water and power in Kyiv?
Yes, good morning. Well, as far as we know, the effects are there. We can feel them. Some water shortages have been reported. So yes, it's as usual. The strikes have been having their detrimental effects.
Are you well prepared if this continues? As you know, this has often been a tactic of Russia to target the infrastructure, whether it's the electricity, the heating in winter, or other supplies, like now water in the summer. Are you able to live with this?
I don't think you can ever be well prepared, to be honest. I think we are trying to be as well prepared as is possible, because we know what's coming and we've been experiencing it for the last 2.5 years. So in that sense, yes, we have been making preparations and contingency plans, but it's always a shock and it's always a crisis situation that you have to respond to.
I know you're an economic advisor, not a military advisor, but everyone is plugged into what is happening on the military front. We heard President Zelensky speaking about the offensive into Russia, into Kursk, which happened about 3 weeks ago. That, of course, is taking a lot of resources. How would you assess how that is going so far?
Yes, so I think what you mentioned at the beginning is very important. I'm an economic advisor, not a military planner or strategic military advisor. But as far as we can see, the situation and the offensive had its first initial success. We've managed to capture a lot of Russian soldiers. That has allowed us to exchange them for our prisoners of war. That is hugely important, of course. Another big, that is the tangible result of the offensive, a short-term tangible result. There's another intangible result, which is also important, which is that it lifted morale, it boosted morale across the front lines more generally in Ukraine of our soldiers. That is harder to measure, but it is there. So that's also very important. But going forward, we'll see what it means and how it will pan out. Of course, there are medium to long-term risks with any operation of that sort, because it carries a lot of risks more generally. We'll see whether we can hold these territories. We'll see how Russia responds, etc.
Because at the same time, there's still the Eastern Front, where Ukraine is still losing ground. And as an economic advisor, you'll know the weight of opening up on 2 major fronts. You have to feed the troops, clothe the troops, replace the troops.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is yet another risk, that it can draw resources away from the main battlefield that was always there, which is the east and the south of Ukraine, and the Donbas in particular. And there have been already reports that ammunition and shells have been missing, perhaps because they were deployed to Kursk. Again, I don't know the exact details, but all of these factors play in and they constitute substantial risks.
Alexander Rodzianski, thank you very much for making time to speak with us on a really busy day.
It is 24 minutes to nine. What effect are smartphones having on children, and what should or could be done to monitor and control their impact on young minds and behaviours? Well, mobile phone provider EE has launched new guidance for smartphone usage aimed at under 16s, with EE recommending under 11s use limited capability, as in non-smart devices. We can talk to Matt Sears, their corporate affairs director, in a moment. But first, let's talk to Kate, who's the parent of three children aged 7, 10 and 17 in Northampton. Good morning to you, Kate. And your children are sort of across that spectrum of Gen Z. So you've seen the effects of smartphones over the years. What have you noticed?
Good morning, everyone. So as a parent, I really welcome this announcement from EE. It only supports the message I'm sort of currently having with my younger children. My hope is that it will have an impact to reduce the peer pressure children and parents are sort of currently facing in environments like primary school. Personally, I hope to delay even longer than 11 and hold off until my younger children are, you know, at least into their teens. But this is definitely a step in the right direction.
Sort of vindicates the message you're trying to send. What, I mean, you mentioned peer pressure, and that's the big thing, isn't it? I mean, if you take a non-smartphone in, or you don't have one at all, then that you can be the source of ridicule amongst other school children.
100%. So my son, my 10-year-old son, he's year five. So that's sort of was in year five. So that's the sort of 9 to 10 age. As parents start to consider that independent walk to school, I think the first thought is safety, security. And I think a lot of parents are not really considering the consequences of handing over a smartphone. I've sort of seen the consequences I've had with my 17-year-old, because
What were those consequences?
It's the distraction. It's the constant sort of it's a constant battle, because as soon as you hand over that smartphone, it just takes their attention. And the massive groups of WhatsApp, you've got not even classroom sizes, you've got year group sizes of WhatsApp groups. You hear people say, oh, children need to self-regulate. They need to learn the importance of online safety. But children are incapable of self-regulating that kind of distraction. And there is, in sort of my friendship groups, I am well aware of parents having to deal with inappropriate messages being sent around in schools. A fight might break out, and they're all filming it and then airdropping it to each other.
Well, let's hear from Matt Sears from EE. Now, you, Matt, have grouped children into three age groups. Just talk us through how this is going to work and what you're trying to achieve.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having me on. We have grouped, you're right, into three age groups, trying to keep it as simple as possible. Most specifically, it's the under 11 category. Under 11s, we feel, should use non-smart devices, as Kate mentioned there, limited capability devices, feature phones. And in fact, we have launched a feature phone this week, or are launching one, the Dash Plus feature phone. But
what does feature phone mean? I don't understand what feature phone is.
This is effectively a non-smartphone. This is a phone like the old school Nokias that people remember.
Got it.
That don't do very much. It will make a call. It will send text messages. There's one or two other things. Perhaps it has a calculator, but doesn't go much beyond there. It certainly doesn't allow for social media. We feel that smartphones themselves should really only start to come in when parents feel comfortable, by the way, but also from our perspective, that might be 11 plus, as a go into secondary school. But again, our guidance here is no social media.
But how do you get around this thing that Kate pointed out there, which is if you're the only kid in class with a non-smart phone, that's a pretty uncomfortable social position to be in.
It is, and it requires quite a lot of strength from parents to try to push back. And indeed, we have seen a lot of classroom parents themselves start to organise themselves into agreeing as secondary school comes along, to agreeing what they can do as a group. So there are a number of things that parents can do, certainly in organising themselves so their children are all in the same position. But ultimately, this will only come with legislation.
Well, I was going to say, what you've issued is only guidance. Could you go further and, for example, work it into the wording of the phone contracts that you have?
Well, we don't sell phones to under 18s. We never have. This really comes largely from parents giving hand-me-downs. And we can't prevent that, nor do we feel it is our role to prevent that. So, whilst we don't think it's appropriate to put into contracts, we do think education for parents is really important. But as I said, legislation ultimately, and perhaps a government consultation in this area, would be the best way to move forward and to get to something agreed across the nation.
Yeah. And Kate, can I just come back to you? Do you think a sort of mobile-free childhood is possible? Is that something we could even aim at?
I think so, and I really hope so. I think there is a desire from parents for this, and we just need that sort of collective action where we all start really supporting each other, and slowly smartphones will become sort of the minority rather than the given. And parents are just considering the consequences prior, and then the choices, because these feature phones are out there, they are available. I think we should push for it 100%.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on, Kate. And also Matt Sear, Corporate Affairs Director for EE. Thank you both. Now then, it is 17 minutes to 9. Definitely or just maybe? I said maybe. Is there an Oasis reunion on the cards? Last night at Reading Festival, Liam dedicated Half the World Away to his brother. So what do you say? You can't give me the dreams of mine anyway. You're half the world away. Well, it's 15 years since they sang in anger together. Miranda Sawyer and Steve Lamacq join us on the line. And Miranda, it sounds like his voice is in pretty good shape, Liam, there. What makes everyone think this is on?
Well, there's just loads of hints, isn't there? I mean, the biggest hint is the fact that both Liam and Noel and Oasis's all social media accounts say 27, 8... 24, 8 a.m, which sounds like there's going to be an announcement, and the announcement is very likely to be a series of gigs. Exciting.
Yeah. and it is because Oasis, I mean, we've had Blur and Suede and Pulp and others, and they have played on, but is the attraction of Oasis because of the enmity of the brothers and the fact they haven't played together in so long?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because actually, both Noel and Liam, of course, have been playing Oasis songs. Like, you know, I mean, Liam was at Liam playing Oasis songs. We just heard him play an Oasis song. The attraction is the two of them together on stage. And that's to do with their relationship. You know, I have a theory that the best bands are a kind of argument between an argument stroke love affair between two people in the band.
Like Jagger and Richards. Nothing,
yeah, exactly. And there's nothing, they are the epitome of that, because obviously, you know, they rowed so hard, they had physical fights. They rowed so hard, they split up. And it's the two of them together, because we don't even know who's going to be playing behind them. We don't know if it's going to be High Flying Birds, if Bonehead's going to come on. We don't know who is going to be behind them. It's the attraction of the two brothers.
Yeah. What, Steve Lamacq, are they still going to have that appeal? I mean, I'm just talking to someone who's in their mid-50s, and so I'm right in the target area. But what about younger people?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a huge audience full of people who never had the chance to see them in the 90s and the noughties. I mean, you could almost double, I think, the audience that saw them at Nebworth. And there, from there, you could probably work out how many people would like to go and see them. But yeah, absolutely, because their legacy is, has lived on and, if anything, has got bigger in many ways. And I think there's a lot of people who'd be desperate to see them, yeah.
I remember there's a bloke from the 1975 who was begging them to get back together again, saying that, you know, they're still the coolest band in Britain, if not the world, and you're not, and you're depriving people of something just simply because you've fallen out with your brother.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, what Miranda's saying is exactly right as well, because, I mean, one of the reasons we're talking about this and people are so excited by it is it's restarting that soap opera that was so popular in the 90s, isn't it? And it shows you just how big they are as characters. I don't think we've created, probably in the last decade or even 20 years, two people in rock music who are responsible for so much copy and are so fascinating because their relationship is so fragile and so fractious.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, Miranda, the parallels with the 90s. I mean, can I just point out sort of new Labour government? Are we going to see a return of sort of Cool Britannia, or is that era well and truly past?
Oh, my God, I hope not. Cool Britannia was terrible.
Oh, there we go.
let's just avoid that completely. Oasis are great. Cool Britannia, no thanks very much. I think it's interesting what Steve is saying about the new audience, though, because if you are our age, you probably have seen Oasis. They played a lot. And that means that if you want to go and see them now, there's a kind of beautiful nostalgia to that. But there are so many people that want to go and see them. So many people would like to see them. And they're a fantastic kind of staging band. You know, not all bands are great stadium bands. They're a great stadium band because they've got songs that people want to sing along with. And that's half the thing of being in a stadium. It's just the huge sing song.
Yeah. And Steve, there's the Daily Mail rather mischievously pointing out that Noel's just had a £20 million divorce. And that could have been behind the reason he has held out for so long, but not anymore.
I don't think either of them are doing it for the money, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, no, honestly, I mean, because, I mean, what sort of thing? I mean, they will get a fantastic paycheck. I mean, the offers for Oasis to reform have been going up year by year. So there will be a lot of money in it for them. But I don't think there isn't enough money in the world to make Noel and Liam sit in a room together. I don't think, unless they actually genuinely wanted to do it.
Okay. Well, thank you both for talking through that. And what you're saying is, if all the clues are to be believed, we may get an announcement on that tomorrow morning. Miranda Sawyer, the author of Uncommon People, Britpop and Beyond in 20 Songs, coming out in October. And Steve Lamacq, he presented The Rise and Fall of Oasis, still available on BBC Sounds. Are you going to do a bonus episode, Steve, for this?
We've already made the call. We've already made the call.
Oh, there we go. Thank you both. Thank you both.
Thanks.
And some breaking news now. In the last few minutes, the London Fire Brigade has been giving an update on the fire, which forced more than 100 residents to evacuate a tower block in London, in East London, in Dagenham. Our correspondent Simon Jones joins us. Simon, what's the update?
Well, we've heard from the London Fire Brigade that they are treating this as a major incident. We know that 100 people plus were led from the building in the early hours of this morning. The crucial thing, though, is that the fire service are unable to tell us at the moment whether everyone has been accounted for. They say that an active search and rescue operation is continuing this morning. We know that 4 people were treated at the scene, and 2 of those had to be taken to hospital by the ambulance service. I've been speaking to some residents. One of them told me that the first he became aware of the fire was when one of his neighbours started banging on his door furiously. She was going down the corridor, making sure that everyone knew that a fire had broken out. It was a frightening experience for the residents. But looking at the building at the moment, there is still a lot of smoke coming from the roof of this block of flats. Another key thing we learned from the fire service is they said there were a number of known fire safety issues with this building. What we think they're referring to is the cladding, because we know that there was cladding on this building that was considered not to be compliant. We've heard a lot about cladding in the wake of the Grenfell Tower fire disaster, and we know that cladding was in the process of being changed. So part of the investigation will inevitably look at whether the scaffolding that was on the building and that cladding may have played a part in this.
We can hear the noise all around you, Simon. Just describe the scene. Are there still residents around? Is it the emergency service? Just paint a picture for us.
There's still a big presence from the emergency services. I'm just looking at the front of the building and I can see maybe four or five fire engines there. We've got two of those high-rise ladders they use to get high up. So those firefighters up there are spraying water onto the roof of the building. That certainly seems to be the focus. We've got police officers here. They've got a cordon. We've also got a number of ambulances parked up in the side street. So I can see five ambulances in the distance. So still a big presence here. And that key thing they want to make sure of is whether everyone has been safely accounted for. But certainly a major operation declared. And this has certainly been a major incident here this morning.
Such a terrible, terrible tragedy. And of course, as you mentioned, people will remember what happened with Grenfell. I'm looking at the BBC's live page and they're saying firefighters arrived on the scene within 5 minutes. The first call at 2:44 in the morning. Must have been panic scenes of people. People were asleep.
Absolutely. And I also spoke to another man who lives nearby and he told me that his six-year-old daughter was actually taking part in a sleepover with some friends inside this block of flats. So he suddenly got a panicked call from his friend saying this fire had broken out. He raced down to the scene straight away and was fortunately reunited with his daughter. But he told me that his daughter and his friends were really shocked about what they'd seen. There was a real sense of panic amongst people as they were trying to get out. Now, the local council has set up a centre nearby for people who have been unable to go to friends or relatives. So they are being offered support here, but certainly for the community here, we think around 60 flats inside this building, more than 100 people living there, and also at the bottom is a nursery, so that too has been affected by the fire, though fortunately wouldn't have been open in the middle of the night.
Thank you, Simon. I'm sure you'll have more updates throughout the day.
Yes, eerie reminders, of course, of that block, you know, a high-rise building catching fire in the middle of the night. When you think about Grenfell, and ironic that they were looking at scaffolding was there to sort of look at the cladding, which of course was blamed in the Grenfell disaster. It is 6:30 to 9
in London. 26-year-old Venetia Stanley is having an affair with the Prime Minister. No, it is not the summer of 2024. It is the summer of 1914, and it's a new novel by the author who has already penned 15 best-selling novels, Robert Harris, and his new book is called Precipice. Robert Harris joins us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Robert.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Now, as you know, historians disagree on whether or not the Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, was actually having an affair with Venetia Stanley, who's described as aristocratic, clever, bored, and reckless. And the Prime Minister, of course, a man more than twice her age. What have you discovered?
Well, several things, really. First of all, I think there's been, either consciously or by accident, a playing down of the nature of the affair, first revealed by Roy Jenkins in a biography of Asquith in 1964. He left out all of the kind of endearments from the letters and only used them to sort of pinpoint where Asquith was and describe political events. And also a lot of details were left out of the collected or selected edition of letters published in 1982. I mean, Asquith wrote 560 letters to Venetia. Sometimes he would write to her three times a day. He'd write to her first in the morning, describing what had happened in the cabinet, and he'd write to her in the afternoon, and he'd scribble a note to her at midnight as well in pencil while he was lying in bed. Asquith was quite a notorious for his fondness for young women, and if he didn't pounce on Venetia, she must have been about the only woman who ever got in the back of his car. He didn't. So I think it's fanciful to suggest that it wasn't in some sense a physical affair. I've also I think, the first to put two and two together with the car. They used to go off for an hour and a half drives around southern England, and the car that he was in, with a chauffeur in the front, the chauffeur was separated from the passenger compartment by a fixed glass screen with a curtain with blinds on all the windows, and the communication between the passengers and the driver was by a push-button console which lit up instructions on the dashboard. So it was almost a boudoir that was being driven around.
And there was some detail that he would show Vivian those top secret telegrams in the car, and then he would throw them out the window and people would find them. That's yes. Astonishing.
This is really what gave me the clue as to how to write the novel. First of all, I thought I'd write Venetia's replies to his 560 letters, because she preserved all his. He destroyed all the letters she wrote to her. To him. Yes, they'd go on these drives, and he would. Foreign Office telegrams from in the summer of 1914 from the ambassadors in Berlin and St. Petersburg, they were called flimsies, the copies that were given to the Prime Minister. They were carbon copies on onion skin paper, if you remember those days. And he would show her these top secret messages, and then he'd screw them up in a ball and throw them out the window. And these were discovered in various places, Henley on Thames. Goring and in St. James's Park, and the local people handed them in to the police, who took them to Scotland Yard, and there was a leak inquiry, because only five people received these telegrams. They were Grey, the Foreign Secretary, Asquith, Winston Churchill, Lord Kitchener, and the Colonial Secretary. So one of them, it was clear, was behaving badly, and I thought, why don't I invent the character who has to make this investigation? And that gave me the way into writing the novel.
And you're still calling it a novel. Does that mean it's going to be completely based on what is, dare I use the word, facts, on what is historically correct or backed up by evidence, or you're going to have a bit of license?
Well, everything that's in the novel that happens is broadly true. I mean, all the letters.
Broadly true.
Well, all the
That's
letters.
Simon's no,
hold on a second.
Broadly
let
true.
Me,
I don't
let
think
me
we
just,
could
let
use
just,
that at the BBC.
Let me just tell you what I mean by that. All the letters from Asquith in the novel are genuine. All the letters that are replies from Venetia, I have had to invent. But the actual events of the novel, the slide into the First World War and the first months of the war, they're all absolutely accurate. They come from the official dispatches that passed across Asquith's desk. I wanted to try and describe the pressures on him. I use a lot of contemporary newspapers and so on. So when I say broadly true, what I mean is I've taken the skeleton of fact and not deviated from it, but tried to fill in the gaps, because I think Venetia was an important woman in British political history who's rather been edited out of it. And when she broke off the affair with Asquith, he seems to have had a sort of temporary nervous breakdown. She broke off the affair on the Tuesday or the Wednesday. The government came in under immense pressure on Friday. And by Monday, Asquith had collapsed the Liberal government and formed a coalition. And there was never to be a Liberal government again. And it's clear that I found a letter which has not been used before. It's clear that he missed her. He relied on her counsel and advice, and the fact that she wasn't around may have had important political consequences.
Oh, is this another incident of women being written out of history? Did 26-year-old Venetia Stanley change history?
I think she had a great influence on it. He showed her secret documents. He sought her advice every day. And when the affair broke off, he clearly had a panic and a loss of nerve. So I think she was very important, and part of the things that I can do as a historical novelist is to try and restore someone like that to public attention.